All right, well, I have 1829.
So you want to try our mouths first?
You want to give your
announcements? Okay. A couple of things. There are some interesting things going on with the Free Linux PC project. The Pickens County Board of Disability and Special Needs is wanting us to essentially set up a computer lab, so we're thinking something similar to Sterling. Also, Prevent Child Abuse Pickens County is wanting us to come help them with their internal network and set up. So those are, if you are interested in doing any of that, if you want to gain experience doing some stuff, you can certainly get involved in that, or if you just want to help out a relatively worthy cause. But we need computers, so if you know of a company that's getting rid of computers, we would like to have some, and we would like to have many, many. And as far as I know, that's all that I have. Go ahead, Rebecca.
Okay. Just for GSATC, that's Greenville, Spartanburg, Anderson Technology Council, they have a couple of events coming up. Tomorrow, they have a learning lunch over at the Crown Plaza, and it's going to be about cybercrime, and they are having their FBI special agent in charge of South Carolina coming in and talking about cybercrime. So that's tomorrow. It starts at 11:30, and it usually goes to about 1:30. Then on the 16th, which is next week, there's going to be Tech After 5. And what this is it is just networking for the technology community in Greenville, Spartanburg, and Anderson. And the first drink is free if you bring a business card. And so y'all can just come on up and hang out at the second level of Barley's. So that's next week.
And my employer is paying for this coming week's beer at Tech After 5, so if you want free beer on my employer, go to it.
I think I'll show up, but I don't want my picture taken when I turn.
You can refuse, I'm sure.
Phil's hard to refuse, though, Jeff.
This is all true. Right.
Anybody got any more announcements?
One more. Yes. We have weekend. This weekend is when they move the Perry stuff up at the Roseman site, the Perry Astronomical. And I sort of need to get a head count on all who's going up there besides myself to help move that on Saturday morning.
What are
he
they
expects
moving?
Expects is bright and early at 8 o'clock.
What are they moving?
They're moving their data center.
Their data center.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
So they're looking for a few strong backs and a couple weak minds.
They're putting in place a 100-plus terabyte SAN that weekend, too. So there's lots of cool things.
Yeah, I think Lamar would like to know simply so he can have a piece of it.
All right. Anybody have anything else? All righty. Well, welcome to the Linux Users Group. You've heard the announcements already. This is how to fry bacon in shell scripts. So, part two of our newbie session on shell scripting. I re-listened to what I did last week and got some improvements this week. So, all right. So, what do you say to me? You say, "Jace, I already know how to fry bacon in Linux. How do I shell script that?" Well, first of all, what is a shell? And outside of Linux, Unix, and computers in general, what would you say a shell is? What does the word mean?
Container.
Like, for example, you have. Anyone?
Clamshells,
which are the outside for the clam, and another shell might be like a
corn.
A corn shell?
Corn shell?
I think of it as a husk, but okay, you could think of it that way.
A nutshell.
A nutshell. Thank you. That's what I was looking for. So what the shell does is it wraps around. It's an external interface that wraps and hides and protects the inside. That's in general. Now in computers, it protects in Linux and Unix in particular. It protects the kernel, which is another word that means multiple things, but you grabbed everything anyway. So the kernel is the interface to all the hardware on the computer,
and gives resources out, and the shell is your interface into that. Now, in Unix, you've got two different kinds of shells. You've got this command line shell, which is what I'll be giving a presentation on, and then you've got the GUI shell. Windows just has a GUI shell. Well, I guess, anyway.
PowerShell.
They still have a command line.
They have a command line, but I don't know if you consider it a shell. So much as a...
They always did.
A shell for the end of the desktop interface.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I guess you did.
Right, the Windows system.
Okay, so a script is putting all the shell commands together into one thing so that you can just, instead of having to type every single one multiple times, you just run the one thing. So let's say, for example, I've got... this little shell script. So I want to just, I'll just do it from the command line. And all it does is it echoes frying bacon to the output. That's where you already know how to do fry bacon, right? So that's, but if I run this, if I run this command, the shell script, it does the same thing, because you see here it's, that's all there is to it. And I've got handouts too. All these papers are handouts. Oh, wait, I was going to do... Oh, yeah. This is for accessing later. Are you recording me? Or is this just one shot?
No, we're recording you.
I know that, but are you? Is this?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you got my backside the whole time. I wish I'd have known that, and I would have.
What's the best side?
I'm glad I think so.
You said not to get your face.
I know. It's just
I was. I thought you were getting his face.
All right. So the simplest script is just, and I'm just going to use the echo command. You see there, you got fry one. You see, it's all it does is just it echoes to the screen the string fry bacon. All right, so that's the simplest. So now let's go a little bit further. Anyone have any questions, by the way? And let me ground rules: newbie session. Anything goes. Any question? Any point? Say I don't know what quote means. You know anything? Okay. Got it? All right. Good. So now let's. All right. So now let's go a little bit further. In the shell, one shell you can have variables. Actually, let me give it back up and go with my comments here. All right. So last month, you remember I talked about the shebang, which is this right here, the pound exclamation point. Boy, that's bright. If the first two characters. First two bytes, I guess, in any file start with those two characters, then the operating system knows that it should execute whatever's after that to the end of the line. That to be the interpreter for the rest of the file. Okay? Does that make sense? So in our case, we've got shell, bin shell, which is where the shell command, it lives in the bin directory off of root, and it's going to execute the rest of this. Any questions? Yes.
In the context of Linux, what is frying bacon?
Well, you know, frying bacon. I don't know. I had to have a clever title so that people would show up. So it's my clever title to have people show up. That's what it is.
If you're using a Pentium 3 and it gets in an infinite loop, you can fry some bacon.
That's right. There you go. That's right. Just put a little slab on top of it. Actually, this thing I think would do really well with that. God, most. Okay. So last month, remember, I talked about the shebang. Normally, comments start with a pound sign and go to the end of the line. With the exception of the first line, which is if the first two characters are sharp, bang, or pound, exclamation point, or hash, what do you call it? Anyway, then this is the interpreter for the rest of the file. Okay, any questions on that? So comments start with a half hash pound symbol and go to the end of the line. It's going to, the shell's going to ignore that. It's useful because, like me, next time you come back in here, you know what's going on. You know, you want to go in through here and say, what is this part doing right here? That's what that's with. Okay? Now here you notice I've got two other comments. Starts from the hash mark, goes to the end of the line, gets ignored, gets thrown out whenever it's interpreted. Okay? Any questions? No. We talked about comments. We talked a little bit about variables, but I'm going to go a little bit further than that. The shell has variables, which you can define to be anything. And so from the command line, I can do anything. And then echo anything that gives me nothing, right? I need to choose different words.
Yeah.
All right, so let me see. Del equals compact. Okay, how's that? Echo del gives me compact. All right, so that's what variables are. Now, variables are case sensitive. So, like, I've changed the case of the last character, and that variable doesn't exist, so it didn't know what to print, so it printed nothing. The empty string. All right, so now in the program here, I've got... and one other thing you'll need to notice is that right here, I did not put any spaces after or before the equals sign. And the reason you do that is if you do that, it's going to think that you're giving it a command. The first token is a command, and the rest are the arguments to that command. Now, since the command del doesn't exist, it doesn't know what to do with the command I found. Does that make sense? Wow, y'all are sharp. I thought I'd have to... Okay, so if you ever get that, and you get a command not found somewhere in your script, and you don't know what's going on, then that's what's going on.
But is spaces acceptable inside a script file?
They are not, for the same reason, because what it's doing is it's simply interpreting. It's just from the same as the command line, it's just interpreting it this way.
Spaces where?
The space before or after equal sign.
Okay.
I don't have one here. All right, so that's variables. Now, you reference your variables with the dollar sign in front of it. So right here I've got the variable meat, and I've got the string bacon. And then here is where I'm referencing the dollar sign meat. Here I've got method equals fry the string, and here I reference it again. Now you notice two different things. I got double quotes here, single quotes here, and right here you notice I didn't have any quotes.
What's the difference between the single quotes and double quotes?
I'm glad you asked. The difference is that with a double quote, that's a string that is one item that can be interpreted if there's variables inside them and a few other things. I can't quite off the top of my head now that I've been asked. But if you were to put a method inside of here with a dollar sign, and then it would also interpret it. Let me show you what I'm talking about.
I would have worded that as anything double quotes is interpreted. Inside is interpreted.
The inside
is a single quote. It's taken as it is.
It's literal. Yes. Yes. Right. Thank you. So this is a literal string. It's going to put exactly what you put inside the single quotes. With the double quotes, it's going to interpret it as it sees fit.
Translated.
I've also not got quotes here at all, but that's okay because this is literal, and there's nothing to interpret here, and there's no other tokens after it. It's a single token. Does that make sense, everybody? I'm serious. If y'all have any questions, feel free to call. All right, great. So now, whenever I go through here, variables quoting, got it, okay. Now I'm doing an echo Oh, here we go. We got the braces. Now, why did I put braces there? Do you mind that? You don't know? Yeah, go ahead.
Because when you do the, what's it called, curly brackets?
Mm-hmm. Curly brackets, yes.
That it says that this part is, hey, I'm not part of the string, I'm the variable.
Right, exactly. So this part of it is the is variable. So if I run this script, out of the way. This is what we had last week. What do I need to do here?
That you need to give the user permission to execute.
By doing
ch mod.
That's right. With the plus execute. Refer to. So now you see that the difference is that between the last time and this time, I now have execute rights, whereas before I did not. Right? Okay, cool. So now I can run it in this way. Frying bed. So now it's off the screen. I was going to say, that's the way to start out.
Sorry.
So,
I just put a little bit in my mouth.
So,
that's probably been the best place to do
it. I left the Linux box at home.
All right, so so whenever you execute this program, it comes through here. The operating system says you want to interpret it through bin shell. It ignores the comments. It assigns to the meat variable bacon. It assigns to the method variable fry. And then it echoes to standard out the variable method ing with the string ing and meat. So the double quote is interpreted, same as if it were up here. So it substitutes this part right here. Now, if I were to change that...
So, if you removed all those quotes from the variable definitions, it would still act the same way, correct?
Yeah.
Did you remove them? Not or spaces? Well, I mean, now, in his example,
right,
I just took them all out.
So if I took that out like that, is there a shot out?
No, the ones where you define the variables.
Oh, okay.
Meat equals bacon, method equals fry, you really don't need the quotes in any of them.
Not in this case, yes.
You're showing an example.
Right. So in this case, no. But this is a simple case, of course. I've got handouts if anyone that just now came in would like. Okay, so any questions about any of that? Okay, any questions about any of that? No.
Okay. Well, that would put single quotes around the string and echo.
That's what I was going to do. Thank you. All right, before I execute it, what's it going to do?
It's going to echo.
It's going to echo the literal string.
All right. Methoding me. And here's another thing I was going to do. If I take those braces off, and execute it, what am I going to get?
Not bacon.
I mean, undefined.
Just bacon.
Just bacon. Right. Great. Any questions so far?
No, y'all are too sharp.
All right. This is not like last month where I had a lot of questions. Okay. So now I'll go into a little bit more detail. All right. Last time my shebang was bin shell. This time it's bin bash, which is on Linux systems the default shell. Bash is a born-again shell. It's the born shell with more spit and polish. A lot more features. Okay, so I've got the... Blah, blah, blah. Okay, introducing command line arguments. All right, last month I did talk about command line arguments, but I'll reintroduce them here. Command line arguments, if I were to give fry some arguments, then the shell uses 04, the name of the program, and then from 1 to 2 all the way on, each argument thereafter. Does that make sense? So what I'm doing here is I'm assigning method to be fry3, because that's what I'll call it as. Meet will be my first argument, and then adverb will be my second argument. Does that make sense? Any questions? No? All right, good. All right, so that's what that happened. That's what happens there. And here again, we got the double quotes, so it gets interpreted and put right in here. All right, so the next thing is if. The way if works in the shell, and you can do this from the command line too, is you've got if command separator, then block phi. That's the syntax of if. Does that make sense? Let me write it down. If command, then commands phi. Alright? So that's how if works. If will go through here and it'll stop at phi. So the test is the command that you want to run. In our case, we're going to use the program called test. You see, I've commented these out, but I'll address them later. Test is, for the most part, probably what you're going to want to use most of the time in if. What test does is it's a program that takes arguments of a certain type, like this one, the equals sign. It expects an argument before and after. And what it does is it returns a true or false if they match. All right? So in our case, fry3 method. Now we know that method is going to be 0, which is the command line, the script. Yes. So now there's a little hack here that you'll see a lot of places. I put a little X at the end. And that is because sometimes if this doesn't exist before it comes to this point, this is going to be the empty string, which gets nothing. And then test is going to say fry3x equals, wait, I need another argument. So that's why you put this little hack. If method does turn out to be nothing, it'll return an x, and then this will fail. It will say false, which is a 1 in the case of test. And then go to the else part, which doesn't exist in my script. So it's actually else, more commands. All right, so this is an optional part, which I don't even have, so that's why it's optional. Okay. Have I lost anybody yet? I've lost no one yet?
That's right. You were born again.
Assembly session. All these other guys that know this stuff, it's not for them.
See what I can afford.
One quick test would, if it returns 0, it's true.
Correct.
If it returns non-zero, it's not true.
All command line programs should return 0 for the type of error. So no error, in other words. There was a return code.
For success.
The return code of most commands. In fact, whenever you do your, I don't know if anyone does any C programming or C++ or whatever you have at the end, return 0. That's what gets returned back to the shell, which means success. Okay. So test, if this were false, would return 1, error 1. Right? So whenever this gets to 0 as a return code, it goes to the then section. Alright, so I'm going to assign in the then section method fry to be that, and then I'm going to echo it out here. Alright, so that's if. test. All right, so I talked about test, the program. Now, you notice I got up here two other variations of the exact same program that's called test. And test is, if you look in your bin directory, you will find a program called left bracket, left square bracket. And it's the same as this. It's either symbolic link or it's whatever. But if you use it in this format, you need to have the closing thing, right? Just, it makes it curry.
That's me.
Okay. And it takes the same kind of arguments. There's a lot of different things that tests do. And last week we talked about built-ins. But I'm not going to. There's some differences between the built-in test and the test that is in bin. But I'm not going to go into that. You can look at your end page. Hey, what's up?
I noticed that one equals is actually two equals.
Right. Yes. The test that. Is in the GNU test that you'll see in Linux, also understands the double equals. So that's for old C programmers that know that double equals means is equal to instead of is assigned as, so that you don't confuse it. But the POSIX standard says that this is right. But test understands both in a Linux system.
Did you recommend to use test?
What?
Did I understand earlier that you recommended using test explicitly?
I didn't recommend.
Okay.
One way or the other. I mean, it's up to you which word you want to use. Certain programs, whenever they're writing shell scripts or interpreting shell scripts, they also interpret brackets to be something else. So sometimes you want to use test instead of brackets. Yeah, I've come across it. Like when you're putting it in a wiki or something like that, you've got...
I guess I would have, I'll tend to use a double bracket, which forces it to use an internal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that uses a built-in, but I'm not going to go into built-in.
Which is less overkill, but that's...
Yeah, I'm not going to go into optimization.
That's
next week. Got to work first, work better later. Right, all right, so we're testing if the string is that string. Test white space. Okay, now here... You notice I've got this huge long line with a lot of white spaces. I've actually got two tabs here in space space, and then this, and blah, blah, blah. What's that going to print out? Shall we find out? Let's find out, Jace.
Talking to myself. All right, so I'll be front three. And what's the first argument going to be the meat?
It'll just print a space delimited, won't it? Because the tab would have to be specified with the slash.
All right.
Well, all right, give me a meat, someone.
Cat.
Cat?
There's another cat lover.
Why the cat shiny? But anyway, okay. And a method for cat, for making cat to eat.
Stir fry.
Oh boy. Permission denied. Okay, well, alright, so I don't have execute rights on this one as well. But there's another way to do this. I can do a shell one is fry three. What's that?
What one might see.
Okay, so we're on. Oh, I didn't do any arguments. Cat, stir. Alright, fly. Alright. What time is it? Okay, I got 2 minutes. Is our guest here? Okay. So now what happened here? Alright, so argument one went in. And it's there. Argument 2 went in, and it's there. That's cool.
The space delimited.
But yeah, so the spaces got gone, right? They weren't interpreted, because what it is echo takes the shell, any command at the shell takes arguments, and it doesn't care about how many spaces between the arguments that you have. So it dropped out all the tabs, all the spaces, all through in here. Now, what if I want to keep the spaces? What do I need to do?
You could do the escape character before it, or you could do quotation marks before it.
Right, we go back to the quotation marks. So if I wanted to have literals, I don't want to do that here, right, because I've got variables. So I want to use the double quote and put it in here. And then that way, we've got one string that gets sent to argue, to echo, and it's one argument, and gets interpreted that way. Okay, so, but now wait a second, I was expecting something else right here. Because if test phi 3x equals method x, method was... Alright, so method was 0. Now when I went to the shell, this would be 0, this would be 1, 2. Method is 0. Method
phi 3. That's correct.
It should be... Now, is that not right? Why did I get this?
So it came out as a 0. So if 0, okay. It's going to jump over.
So this test said, wait a minute, this is dot slash phi 3.
You called shell instead of... Mm-hmm.
You
right,
call
but shell knows
that they call bash.
Dot slash phi 3 is not
phi
3.
Exactly.
So I did it with the dot slash. Now, since I'm using the shell, I can do it this way. And there's my frying with a capital F instead of that dot slash fry. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. All right, because I got the test. Didn't match because I had a dot slash in front, so it's literal string. Okay. Let me do one more thing. Can't find something.
Boldly.
Frying cat stir fry.
Can't stir fry with red.
Wait a second. What are we?
No. Yeah. You don't have the. You're
not assigning that.
No, it had three variants.
Frying cat boldly is.
Yeah, okay. Alright. Frank Cat, that's what I was expecting. Yeah, film for. Okay. Right. Now, if I don't give it that, then that's where I get no error. And that's where it's.
Test, one of the commands that test, or one of the arguments the test take is zero length adverb. So it tests if adverb is zero length, which in this case, you know, it was because there was nothing there. Makes sense? This returns a zero to this, which means false. I'm sorry. This returns a
zero.
True. True is
not zero.
True is zero. True is zero. True is no zero. Error. If says goes into here, then there was no error. And here's the third type of quoting, the backslash. You see I've got quotes here, so it gets interpreted. Normally this would be adverb, but since I've got the backslash, I've quoted out, I learned it as quoting. There's three types of quoting, double quote, single quote, backslash quote. So you're quoting the character dollar sign. Make sense? All right. One last thing. I'm sorry. Okay. All right, roast. We do the same thing. Roasting cat bowling. Now there, that goes back to the... You had asked, why would I want to even mess with dollar sign zero? Well, what if you've got a symbolic link or another link to the same program? It's going to be fry 3 whenever you run it as fry 3. It's going to be roast whenever you run... roast, and then you get roast and kettle. Any questions? Yeah, are there no newbies in the audience today?
No, I didn't think so.
All right. Thank you all for your time. I've got you. I've got printouts of the stuff there if you don't want.
And he did something really geeky. He's actually did all the work on his EXO laptop, which he VNC'd into with someone else's laptop. And he then projected onto the screen.
I tried to. That didn't work because the font was so huge.
Well, he did have it working before people showed up.
Okay, all yours.
All right.
And for those of you who don't know, although I assume by all the faces, this is Iculus, our Ryan Gordon.
Please call me Ryan. I'm always scared when people call me, you know, by a fictional character's names.
I assume that you chose the fictional character's name.
Well, it's a bit of a story. I'll probably get into
it. Okay. I first heard about him when he was doing Google Earth.
Yes.
He was on BidRev Radio, and one of our list members' groups, and if the other guy's name was interviewing you.
Chris DeBona, probably.
No, this was Binary Revolution. This wasn't...
It's been quite a while.
But I had no idea he was in Charlotte. And then we had it pointed out that he's in Charlotte and got him invited. And we're thrilled to have him.
All right. I'm glad to be here. I couldn't find the place. I was terrified that you all just got bored and left. Thank God. There was a Dash tutorial going on. I'm going to try and find a power outlet real quick. Last time I gave a talk, my laptop died in the middle, which is always embarrassing because not only do I not know what I'm saying right now, it's even worse when you don't have notes. So I'm going to try and find the plug here. I recognize that green plug right there.
Yeah.
All right, good. I have to apologize because I'm using both a Mac and I'm wearing an Apple shirt, but I did see someone in this room on their laptop on store.apple.com, so I am in good company. So just as a show of hands here before I get started, I'm not... sure what kind of talk I should be giving tonight. How many people are... Just raise your hand if you are. It's okay if you're not. How many of you would call yourselves programmers? How many would just call yourselves just general Linux users or fanboys or, you know? Okay. How many of you think of yourselves as game developers?
All right.
A lot more of you should be raising your hands. A lot more of you are game developers than you think you are.
Uh-oh.
This is not my speech, I promise.
How do you pay by the game developer?
You should find a new job then.
We got the Hydra console.
What's that?
So we got this guy, the Hydra console.
The Hydra console?
Hydra game development console. It uses the propeller chip.
I haven't heard of
this. How many cores does the CPU?
12 core.
Wow. Oh my gosh. That's a lot of cores.
That's the birthday present I ever got.
Okay. So I like to ask, because I like to try and, you know, gauge the talk roughly how people would be most interested, and I don't have a plug, so. This is actually kind of a PowerPoint thing, but it's okay if it doesn't plug in, because I'm mostly just going to use it as notes, so. I'll tell you a little bit about myself, but I'm mostly boring, so I won't keep you too busy with this one. When I was in high school, my debate teacher made everyone the first day of class get up and talk about themselves for 5 minutes. And like every high schooler, that's like the worst experience on the planet, right? Because it's like, you know, having to stand in front of a class for 5 minutes is terrifying. And, you know, people are stuttering and they're like, and they can talk for about 3 minutes before they want to pass out and die on stage. He pointed out the really important fact that, like, you really do, except for this 3 minutes of your life, talk about nothing but yourself for your entire life. So what's so hard about doing it for 5 minutes when everyone's looking at you? In theory, this should be your best dream come true. So I'm going to talk about myself for about 4 minutes because I'm not that egotistical. But, okay, so my name's Ryan. If you don't know me, I get introduced to conferences as the Linux game industry, which is funny, but it's also a problem. We'll get into it. You might know me if you've ever played a video game on Linux. I've worked on titles like Unreal Tournament 2003, 2004, and maybe someday soon you'll be seeing Unreal Tournament 3. I've worked on Serious Sam. I've worked on America's Army. I've worked on Medal of Honor. A number of games, both in terms of like the boring dedicated server work and in terms of the cool graphical 3D OpenGL magic stuff that you see. I've done them both to the best of my ability, sometimes better than others. One of the things that I've been doing recently, and he mentioned this, was that I've been working with Google and shipped a Linux version of Google Earth, and we're going to get into that also. But the thing that I'm most proud of is the stuff that doesn't make me money. I run a site called iculus.org. That's iculus.org. We joke that we call it SourceForge with soul. I don't know if that's as funny anymore because I think everyone makes fun of SourceForge now. No? Okay. SourceForge, when I first started iculus.org, I had just gotten The company I was working for was called Loki Games, and it had just fallen apart, and I had a couple of open source things that I was playing with, and I wanted to have other friends and people in the community that I thought were really talented hackers in the Eric Raymond form of hacking and not the CNN form of hacking. I wanted to give them a small community where it was... I don't think I even have an outlet for that. Also, I probably have curse words in this. I don't really want to show it to you. Plus, I'm probably just going to be motivated to Rickroll you all if I get access to the you got to take the opportunities when you can. We had this site. When I left Loki, I went to, and we'll talk about Loki also, but when I left Loki, I went back to Pennsylvania and moved in with my parents because I was poor and young and stupid, and everyone does it at some point in their life, and if you didn't, then please humor me and pretend you did so I don't feel like a loser. I don't live with them anymore. But I was living up in Philadelphia with it there, and I had a friend who had just opened one of those really cool cyber cafes. This is like the next generation of the arcade. They plug a T1 line into the thing and set up like 30 high-end computers, and everyone plays Counter-Strike all night, or World of Warcraft, or back in the day it was Dark Age of Camelot. You know, really, it was arcades were dying, but this was going to be the next thing. People would pay X dollars per hour to be there. And I went to this guy, who was a friend of mine, and I said, I had this crazy idea. I don't know if anyone's ever thought of this before, but I'd like to borrow some bandwidth on your T1 line and, you know, get a dedicated IP address. And I don't just want a website, because, you know, everyone can go to GeoCities or whatever was the big thing at the time and, you know, put up a crappy website. But I want to, you know, have control over the ports so I can have, like, a CVS server up there and, you know, mailing lists and, you know, bug tracking and all this stuff that you just can't do on any rented website, which has become less true nowadays. You can go to Dreamhost and get this for $15 a month. But at the time, it was really, really, I thought, unheard of. And he goes, oh, you mean, like, co-location? Like, oh, there's a word for that? Yeah, that sounds good. So he gave me space on the T1 line for this, and then we had one little crappy box, which was like a 486 that was in storage from when I was at Loki, and I think it had a 4 gigabyte hard drive, and I was like, I will never fill this. This is too awesome. So much space. In fact, we're backing up to a single rewritable CD-ROM drive every night, which we just couldn't fill. You know, it's not enough space on there. And eventually... look at that. Someone calls me as soon as I start talking. Shame on you. So after a while of that there, I started getting complaints from this place that I was hosting at. Because remember, it's a game store. It's meant for people to pay money to play video games and have high-speed internet access and all that stuff. I started getting complaints because we were using all of their bandwidth on the T1 line for people downloading things like, you know, the open source version of Duke Nukem 3D and stuff like that. And just there was just this massive influx of the universe coming in to, you know, pull stuff off our server where someone had packaged up a Linux binary for, Free Space 2 or something like that, some game like that. It's like, oh, 30 megabytes of download. It's no big deal, especially in today's day and age when, you know, bandwidth is cheap and plentiful. But back then, we were saturating this T1 line. So my best friend kicked me out of his own store, and we moved on to greener pastures at professional hosting then. But ikils.org is the name of the website, and we, at the time, we had set this thing up to have like 3 or 4 people that used to work at Loki or were really talented hackers, and they were all handpicked because they were not just good at what they did, but they were also prolific in what they did. And we're just, you know, we're starting to see a revolution in commercial games at the time. We're starting to release source code to their video games, which used to be their intellectual property, you know. And, ooh, that's scary. We can't let people see the source code to this game that we are never going to sell another copy of again. So, but, you know, things started changing, and now I'm getting into my talk here. And I believe that this probably started... Who was the first one? Was it Doom? I think it was probably Wolf 3D. Wolfenstein 3D. Who's played it? If you haven't raised your hand, you're probably too young, sorry, kid. Or you need to get out more, or less, whichever applies. And
get in more.
Yeah, anyway, this game at the time, I'm sure for those that haven't played it, it was probably the first game that really had the strong concept of go shoot the Nazis, which, you know, if it's a Nazi and it moves, go shoot it. An admirable attitude, I suppose. But id Software is the name of the company that made that, and they decided they're never going to make another dime off of this game. So they said, put the source code out there. And it went pretty well. You know, people downloaded, people started porting it to Linux, people started, you know, adding OpenGL rendering to the thing and stuff like that. But I started to notice that there were people in the community that any time this would happen, it happened a couple more times in relatively rapid succession, because Wolf worked out really well, and then the Doom source code came out, and that worked really well, and the Quake source code came out, the original Quake, and it's been spiraling out of control from there, largely spearheaded by id Software. But every time one of these games got released, there was always three or four people, it was always the same three or four people that would jump on this, and like 24 hours would pass, and there'd be a complete Linux version of it, which was unheard of, because it was a DOS binary 12 hours earlier, you know, so unbelievable. So I wanted to give these people a place to do this work. Because a lot of times we'd be like, who has a piece of server space on a college server somewhere? For a while we were hosting a CVS server at UCLA and stuff like that. I mean, that just doesn't scale well because people have the audacity to graduate. if any of you are still in college, if I could give you some advice right now, it's never graduate. Because the real world, it really stinks a lot. So just stay in school forever. You don't have to pay the student loans until you graduate. So just stay there as long as you can. So we set up the server. And you're laughing because you know I'm right.
Because I know somebody in the room who had a reputation for 10 or 12 years.
Smartest man in the room. Where are you? Raise your hand.
Perpetual student.
Good. Smartest man in the room.
Okay, it only took me 14 years.
We're not judging you. I think that's a very wise thing to do. So we set up the server, and just it was two or three people, and you know, they get their own email address, and I had a friend that had a mom that wanted an email address, so we set that up, and blah, 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 like that. Eventually, it kind of spiraled out of control, and we ended up... today, we have about 100 developers, but... And it's largely SourceForge-like things. If you need a mailing list, we'll do it. If you need a bug tracker, we'll do it. Someone the other day decided they need Git support. If you haven't used Git, it's scary but impressive at the same time. And you know, so we set up a Git server for them, git.iculus.org. And then someone else named Mercurial, and now we have hd.iculus.org. So you know, we'd like to think the problem with SourceForge is that you say, I have a problem with SourceForge, and all you hear is crickets in response. Chirp, chirp, chirp. You know, your problems never get fixed. And, like, the server might go down for 6 months and nobody will ever fix it for you, you know, and problems like that. So so we felt that Iculus.org was a response to that. But one thing that we had, and I think this is the primary difference, those things are all just technical issues, but the primary difference between SourceForge and Iculus.org, I think, is that we're really kind of elitist jerks. everyone knows that guy. In fact, you might be that guy. In fact, I've been that guy before that sets up the project and he's totally going to make a game better than Doom 3, and he's got it set up with his friends, and they've set up a website, and they're setting up t-shirts from Cafe Press, and you know, they've got one header that's kind of half written in a CVS server somewhere, and then magically nothing ever happens on this project after that. This is actually okay. I refer to these jokingly as intellectual exercises, that everyone has some intellectual exercises. Like, they sit down, they're going to totally write a database that's better than MySQL or whatever. They're going, and sometimes these things do happen, you know, but, or they're totally going to write their own operating system. It's going to be better than Linux, but it's going to have better 3D drivers than Windows, but it's all going to be object-oriented, even though they don't actually know what that means. Those people go to SourceForge, and there's 10,000 or more, and I'm not exaggerating, because you can go look for yourself. There's 10,000 or more projects just like that that have one file in CVS or no files in CVS, and just a forum set up with two guys asking questions that never get responded to, except maybe in vague general, oh, we're totally going to do that after the version 1 release. I hate those projects. I think they're great. I have a whole hard drive full of them that are my own. I just don't think you should waste everyone's time on that, because sooner or later they show up in Google and you're like, man, I totally need something that turns Word documents into, you know, WordPerfect 5 documents, something obscure no one's ever done before, and it's, although I'm sure that's probably been done before, but and you go and you search on Google for this, and the only hit is this SourceForge project that has no source code, you know, and it just seems like that's a waste of time. You're actually making the internet a little worse in that regard. So, so Iculus.org, we took a lot of effort to reject people. And Liz Torvalds, and I'm sure he's not the only one, famously said that his job as a manager on the Linux kernel is telling people no. You know, that's too ambitious in realistically ambitious ways. And, you know, that's just simply not going to work, and you're wasting my time. And a lot of times he comes off as harsh, but he's very rarely wrong, which irritates everyone. And we kind of try to have the same attitude with ethos.org. I get a lot of email from people saying, hey, can I have some server space because I need a website and I need this and I want to put some stuff into source control. And I spend a lot of time telling people no. And after a while, you kind of get to the point where you can't find nice ways to say that's just simply never going to work. I found the best way to say come back to me when you get a little progress. It's too soon to publish. Believe it or not, there is a such thing as being too soon to show the world your work. And whether the project's going to fail or not, there is a such thing as too soon. And was it the Cathedral and the Bazaar once said that the best plan is to release early and release often? Flat out wrong. The best thing to do is release often, but not early. You want to make sure that the thing is mostly usable before you put it out there. Even if it's got a ton of features missing, and even if it has, you know, major deficiencies and bugs, it has to do more than just say hello world. Unless it's actually GNU hello, then that's all it has to say. But it has to do more than just have a header file. Because the horrible, dirty secret of open source and free software is that people don't show up. Most of the best software out there, until it becomes the size of X11 or the Linux kernel, doesn't get written by more than one person, for the most part. You hear about even big projects like Ruby on Rails, and you can pick out an actual developer that is the Ruby on Rails guy, DHH, or you can pick out the Python guy, and certainly lots of people contribute to Python, but it's still Guido Van Rossum is still really the Python guy. There's a lot to be said for open source, and all the things they say about the benefits of it happen to be true. But generally speaking, you got to assume that you're going to be the only one working on your project and consider it a blessing when other people show up and contribute good stuff. That being said, I've turned into an elitist prick, and I just, you know, send people away when they come in with great ideas and crush their dreams. That's what I do. I'm not proud, but that's how it goes. So, and I said I was going to talk about myself for 5 minutes, but now this is actually kind of dovetailed. So I actually want to talk to you today about the Linux game industry. The last thing I'll say about ethos.org for now is that the reason we set it up eventually is not everything on it is game-related, but we do have a gaming slant. We want to try and build things that are important for gaming on Linux. And we'll talk about some of those things a little later on. So here's your 20-second overview of gaming on Linux. And it'll probably be more like 25, but you'll have to forgive me. Okay. December 9th, 1994. See, this is how far back we're going. That's like, were you even born then?
Yesterday.
What was the year?
1994. Happy birthday. Good. I don't mean to single you out. I just, you know, I'm happy to see young people here because, you know, I'm afraid we're all going to be old and talking about Linux back in the good old days and telling people to get off our lawn. We need new blood here. Okay, so in 1994, December 9th, Dave Taylor, who's a game developer and has moved on to other pastures now, he does a lot of interesting things, released a version of the original Doom for Linux. And I'm sure this is not the first Linux game. I'm sure there's lots of open source stuff that came before it, like XBuild or something like that. But this was the first commercial Linux title that I'm aware of that was, you know, this was a big deal. This was, lots of operating systems declare victory as soon as that first game shows up. BIOS had Civilization Call of Duty. OS 2 had something called, what was it called, like Stardock or something like that. But it was like, victory, we win! There's a commercial piece of software for our operating system. And it doesn't work that way, of course. You need to have a continual steady stream of stuff. But at the time, this was exciting. This was a million college students on internet lines at their universities, because really most people didn't even have dial-up in 1994, with the exception of probably everyone in this room. Am I right about that?
Yep.
Okay, good. Suddenly you could go to an FTP server and download a Linux binary. And the readme for it had a couple of pertinent things I want to point out. There's a quote from Dave Taylor in this saying, it doesn't generate revenue. They make no money off of this. They make money, obviously, they're selling a shareware version of Doom for DOS, and that's where obviously most of their customers are, right? But the reason, and this is in the readme, you can still download this today and see this. This is a direct quote. He says, I did this because Linux gives me a Woody. Some things you can't make up. That's what he said. And I bring that up, one, because it's funny, and two, just I think you're going to find this is a pattern throughout history if you look at gaming on Linux, and frankly, if you look at most technology on Linux, closed source or open source, sooner or later, somebody got a Woody from doing it, so... just sounds awful. We're going to move on. Okay, so Dave Taylor continues his reign of Linux terror by going on to start his own company called Crack.com, back when that was actually the domain name. It's been sold since then. He wrote a game called Abuse. It was a side-scrolling thing. You could shoot in 360 directions with your robotic soldier-looking dude by moving the mouse around. And at the time, it was completely awesome. Sold it as shareware. It's now open source, by the way, because Crack.com went out of business, and Dave Taylor, being Dave Taylor, said... have the source code. Oh, that might have been before Wolf 3D. But they had a Linux version before they went out of business. They one of their goals was to have not just the DOS binary they expected to sell to everyone, but a Linux version that they also wanted customers to buy and download. Crack.com went on to try to make a 3D game back when the industry made that jump from Super Mario Brothers to Super Mario 64, when everything that was 2D suddenly, you know, became 3D. They tried to make a game called Golgotha, which, for those that don't know, is where they crucified Christ. But it was a game; it was a war, like a tank warfare game. And they went out of business. They ran out of money. And he said, "The game's not done. It's not playable. Here's my source code. Do whatever you want. If you can build a game on the foundation we've made, more power to you." I don't know any games that were made on it, but there's a lot of good artwork in it. You know, people, I think, cherry-picked a few choice things from it. Dave and his programmers were not stupid. They made some very nice code. But after that, everything got very quiet for a while. Because, Civilization Call to Power on BIOS, or whatever that game's name was on OS 2, it was the Great White Hope. This is, proof that we've made it, that we're at the big time, that this is, you're not going to get beat up for our lunch money anymore. Well, when Crack.com went out of business, we're getting beat up for our lunch money again. We expected them to deliver. They never did. And now no one else was delivering. And people went, oh, I guess Linux was a joke after all. Well, big mistake, but at the time it felt pretty bleak for everyone. Then, thankfully, the next generation came along. That was the one with Picard. I'm going to keep making bad jokes if you keep laughing at them. But the next generation came along, and I'm talking about things like Loki software. Does anyone here own a Loki game? Thank you. You're the only one that kept me fed at the time. I was working for them at the time. They came along, a company named Hyperion came along and did a game called Shogo and a game called Sin. Tribsoft came along and did a game called Jagged Alliance. And Vicarious Visions came along and did a game called Terminus, which was kind of like Wing Commander. And they were all awesome. Loki was the biggest of these at the time. They shipped, I think, 16 commercial pieces of software. And these were big-name games. They were talking about things like Civilization Called Power. There's that BIOS to look at. But they're doing things like Quake 3, SimCity 2000.
Sid Meier's Appleson, sorry. I own
all of them,
by the way.
Well, I do too. Good. It makes two of us in the room. Heavy Metal Fact 2, Descent 3, other things like that. A lot of games. And at the time, I was amazed at one point. I went into a place called Media Play, which is like Fry's or Best Buy. I don't know what they have in South Carolina, but one of those CompUSA, one of those big media, big hardware stores. And I'm looking, they have a shelf of the top 10 selling games at the time, and I was like, we're shipping that, we're shipping that, we're shipping that, we're going to ship that, we have a deal in line for that. And I was like, oh my god, like 8 of the top 10 selling games for Windows run natively on Linux. This is the big time. Well, I was wrong about that, too, and we'll get to that momentarily. Loki software went out of business for a lot of reasons, which I'm probably not legally allowed to get into. So it goes, but there were some questionable business deals and other things there.
Where were they located?
They were located in Tustin, California, which is like Orange County. If you were to think like Los Angeles, Disneyland, Mexico, we're right in between Disneyland and Mexico. We're not there. Nobody's there anymore. We're not a business. But this time frame where all this was happening was like late 99, all the way through 2000, maybe early 2001 is when things started to fall apart, which for those of you who are historians of the internet sounds an awful lot like the dot-com bubble. Yeah. So as that burst, everything else went with it. There were probably other reasons, but it didn't help that nobody could get venture funding when they were running out of money, and Loki was another sufferer of that. This is when things fall apart for everyone again. Hyperion, believe it or not, stopped doing Linux titles because they decided they'd rather do Amiga titles. Do they even sell Amigas? Have they sold those since the Commodore 64 was popular?
I'd buy one.
They did in the UK.
All right. The thing I've never understood, I don't want to get off on a tangent here, but as far as I know, the Amiga was really a great piece of machinery when it shipped, but all the way through like 2000, I was hearing people being like, oh, you can do that on an Amiga. Really? I don't understand. Is that actually physically possible? That seems like that would break some physical laws of, like, Gordon Moore is laughing at you right now. So Loki had some baby mama drama. We're not going to get into that. Hyperion abandoned Linux for Amiga. Tripsoft went out of business. I think they were just another company that ran out of money. It just happened to everyone at the time. Vicarious Visions, the guys at Terminus, started doing Xbox games. They're still around today. They do a lot of ports for people. In fact, they did Doom 3 for the Xbox, the original Xbox. And finally, everyone starved for quite a while. So that's where we were. But the thing is, where we are is not quite dead yet. We might be able to upgrade that from the last time I gave this speech. But there are more people now making games than there were at the time. Loki was kind of unique in itself that it wanted to make games that were... It wasn't making games of its own. It was trying to... It was a publisher. It would go in, port some game, like give us the source code to Deus Ex or something like that. We'll port it. We'll maintain the port. We'll do the bug fixing, the community interfacing, and we'll sell it. And this model is really, really scary if anyone's ever done this before, because you find out that to port the game might take you 6 months, although we had a couple that took 24 hours. It depends wildly on code quality. And I don't know if anyone's ever worked in video games before, but the video game industry is not really known for code quality, generally speaking. Then again, who is? But today, that model didn't work so well. There's still one company doing that called Linux Game Publishing, and they can survive partially because they're very, very selective. They'll publish maybe one game a year, two games a year. If they're really ambitious, they'll do three games a year. But they don't do anything that's not, unless it's going to be pretty much a slam dunk that's going to cost them very little and make them at least a modest profit. That probably makes them smarter, but it makes them also a lot less fast-paced, a lot less accelerated in what they want to do. But I've found since then the Loki model, generally speaking, doesn't work. If you're going to come in after the game is already shipped and start porting it, games tend to have a shelf life on Windows, at least. This is not true on other platforms, but on Windows they do, because there's so much competition for the high end that you can have a AAA title that you spent 5 years making and $40 million making, and after 3 weeks, no one will put it on their shelves. You know, so you've got to make your $40 million plus in about 3 weeks. And that's a very, very scary proposition for the people that originally made the game. For the Linux people, they have that problem, but that 3 weeks ticks by, and they've barely even started pushing it through GCC to see if it builds. So we had a huge amount of trouble at Loki with people being like, this game was awesome on Windows 3 months ago, but I've moved on. I don't want this anymore, and they don't want to buy it, you know. And or worse, I bought it on Windows when it first came out. Now I should get this for free, right? Because nobody's like had put any effort into this, right? So I found that model doesn't work very well. But the model that works much better is if you have these things ported to Linux before they ship. Now that means you can't have a Linux publisher. It just simply doesn't work in this day and age. But if you go to individual companies and say, I hear you have a game that's coming out in a year, because PR for these games start a year before it's, you know, as soon as they can put together enough footage for a trailer, they'll release a trailer. In fact, I hear this is actually the Duke Nukem Forever model of, in general, there's no actual game, it's just they keep putting out trailers. I'm sorry, George, if you hear this podcast. But generally speaking, if you know this game's going to come out, and also you can make some assumptions, like if Doom 1 was awesome and Doom 2 is awesome and 5 years have gone by and you hear there's a new game coming out from it, chances are it's probably Doom 3 and it's also going to be awesome. You have all this lag time, and more so with things like, I'm trying to think of a good example now, my mind has gone blank, but pick any game that has a 2 after it. Chances are it's because the first one sold really well. So you target those companies, and you talk to them, and you say, you know, you need a Linux version for a whole bunch of reasons, which I'll get into shortly here. And you try to make these deals, and if you make these deals, you get in there and you start porting the game, and you work as a development person. And when I say you, I mean me, but I'm giving you advice in case you want to change careers. If you can get in there, you work as a regular member of the team, but you do what I would refer to as the dream team thing. This works best whether you're a Linux advocate or not. If you're a game developer or a database developer or you're making the most awesome word processor ever, whatever, the best thing you can do for your piece of software as a commercial entity is make sure you have whatever the scales out to in ratios for the actual number of people working on it, one Windows developer, one Linux developer, and one Mac developer that are all working from the latest code base and all developing for the program, not necessarily porting it, but they're all working towards that final product. But they're all working on their own platform. So as soon as something non-portable gets checked in, and it's always the Windows guy. I don't want to name names here, but it's always the Windows guy that checks in like something that just is very operating system specific. You know, some Win32 call or, you know, they hard code C:\program files or something in there. Which, by the way, doesn't work on Win64. So they're screwed there, too. In that case, the Linux developers can help them even on Windows. So you have each of these developers, and they're all just working towards developing this program, but they're all doing it on their own platform. As soon as something non-portable gets checked in, it's fixed immediately. The next time that the Linux and Mac guy update from source control, or if the Mac guy sticks some Quartz call in there, the Windows guy is going to catch it. And just as you go along, you keep the thing portable. And porting something at the end of its life, when it's right about to ship, is very, very expensive in terms of money and time, man hours, and just, you know, the amount of soul that gets crushed by having to do this, you know, right when you were hoping to go on vacation. But if you do it all along, you can amortize that cost to the point where you don't even notice it. In fact, the cost probably goes way down. It's not even a question of just about spreading the cost out over the lifetime of the product. With that in mind, I've started moving in and sometimes sleeping under desks at places like Epic Games. And I got called, without getting into all my sordid history about a whole bunch of companies, but I got called by Epic Games because they need a Linux dedicated server. And this is always the way in. You get these games that are multiplayer games, and I blame John Carmack for this, but every game has to have a multiplayer deathmatch mode, just the same way that everything a couple 10 years ago had to eventually grow until it sent email, and now everything grows until it can play MP3s. Every game had to grow until it had a multiplayer deathmatch, even if it didn't make sense. I think even like Tetris and Bubble Bobble have it now. So.
We're better off for it.
Oh, I agree, actually. I think in the grand scheme of things, it fits better in some things than others, but... And there's been a lot of, you know, Me Too development. Like, everyone needs to, you know... I don't think we needed a Star Trek game that looked just like Quake 3, except with phasers. Wait a minute. Yes, we did need that. I stand corrected. Okay, anyway, but since you have this multiplayer component to every video game that ships now, everyone needs a dedicated server to play it on. Because back in the day, it was, you know, Duke Nukem 3D or Descent 1 or something like that. You had two dudes... with nothing better to do with their time, such as myself, that would try and get two modems to talk to each other by calling each other's houses, and they would play these games against each other, just one-on-one. But that does not scale, because, you know, when Quake 1 shipped, or when the original Doom shipped, it was like, you can have four people play, but you can't have four modems call each other. It just doesn't work, you know, unless you have some central place, but no one was thinking like that. You have to have a network, a LAN, an Ethernet connection. So it's fast, so you have enough bandwidth for four people, and you don't have to worry about how they talk to each other. That facility is already inherent in a local area network. Then those troublemakers went on and made a game that, you know, did this over the Internet, and the rest is history. But the point being that if you want to support 32 people, 64 people, in the case of World of Warcraft, 100,000 people on one server, you need to have a machine that does nothing but tell the other machines what's going on in the game. And for those that played the original Descent, sometimes when you were playing on the modem, because nobody was the boss, so sometimes you would fire a missile at someone, watch the missile hit their ship and explode, and the other guy would be like, what just happened? Nothing hit them. Because both machines have been calculating this on their own and came to a different conclusion about what just happened there. I don't want to say it was bad design, because they just did what they had to do there. In fact, the concept that you have one authoritative source, one machine that decides for everyone, was really a radical concept when the original Quake did it. In fact, Quake is really interesting in the fact that even when you're just playing with... I was going to say playing with yourself, but, you know, even when you're just playing a single-player game... even when you're playing a single-player game, there's... it still thinks you're playing a multiplayer game. It just stops sending stuff over an Ethernet card. It just sends them between memory buffers. But as far as it's concerned, you're just the dedicated server at that point. It's also drawing some graphics. Once you got to that point, you started realizing, well, if people want to play with all their friends, both of them, but, you know, you get some people that actually are popular. Like Paris Hilton plays a game, 16 people want to join with her. You can't do it unless you have an authoritative machine. So you have the dedicated server show up. And then it didn't take long for people to realize Windows makes a really crappy dedicated server. Less so now, to be perfectly fair, because XP is not bad in terms of a server machine.
Yeah.
But we're talking about Windows 95, ladies and gentlemen. It was not... it was an ugly scenario. So, and people were finding out that if there was a Linux dedicated server, it ran fast, it ran on lower-end hardware, you could run it remotely because you could telnet into it, which you couldn't do on a Windows 95 machine, and, you know, it didn't want to reboot every 3 minutes. You know, all those things that you kind of want in a dedicated server. Could you imagine if eBay rebooted every 3 minutes? I mean, come on. But so you have this... So people started to do this math, and they started realizing, and you can thank Valve Software for this one, because there's this game called Half-Life, which nobody played online, but there was a mod for Half-Life called Counter-Strike. Who's played it? I get the impression all the gamers are on this side of the room. You might want to move over here, sir, just, you know, to be with your own. But that's okay. Counter-Strike is a really frustrating game. It's a lot of rehearsal of maps and knowing where to be and knowing how to cheat most effectively. It's really not a satisfying experience, but for some reason, it exploded. Everyone wanted to play it. And instead of being like, well, there's 100 Quake servers, or there's 100, I don't know, Descent servers, or whatever people were playing at the time, there was like 10,000 Half-Life servers playing Counter-Strike. And that's big. That's huge. That could very well be every person that's playing a video game on the internet was playing Half-Life at some point or another. It was significant. And more significant, Valve had the foresight to realize that you have to ship a dedicated server for Linux, because that's what people want for all the reasons I said about Windows 95. And once you have that, the next interesting thing happens. Whenever you have something that takes a bit of effort, a little bit of technological understanding, you get this vacuum of talent. Because not, especially back then, it's a lot easier now when you just pop a Ubuntu CD in and do your magic, but back then you had to know a little bit about command lines, and I know you all do now because you just had a bash session, but rock and roll. But at the time, that was really scary. And in fact, if you were new to bashing, it was probably very scary sitting here, too. It was like, you know, that dream you have where you're naked in class. Back then, you actually need a lot of, I don't want to say talent, but you needed talent. You needed to have some experience with Linux if you wanted to run a dedicated server. So whenever this happens, you have basically a market. Now, markets don't ever go away, and this is why we're not dead yet with Linux video games, too, is that once you have a market, there are people that make their entire livelihood now selling dedicated servers. I don't mean selling, I mean renting. Where you pay $20 a month, and you and your friends get their own personal Linux server that's guaranteed not to crash, and someone's going to take care of upgrading it and making sure it works well and it runs quickly and that the bandwidth is really sweet. It's not going to be some jerk on a DSL line selling this to you. And there's a real competition for it. And computers are expensive, and bandwidth is expensive, relatively speaking, and it's a very razor-thin margin for some of these people. And the first thing they realized when they sat down and looked at their financial books, said, what can we cut to save money, to deal with, to be able to compete better with the other people that are renting dedicated servers? And they went, how much does that Windows license cost?
Mm-hmm.
Per machine. That much? That's a lot. And then everyone stopped running Windows. And what we've discovered now is... I'm trying to think of the actual statistic here. The sales, we have a rough idea of the number of people that played Unreal Tournament 2004 on Linux. because when you connect to the master server, which is to say, hey, give me a list of games that I can play on, it'll say, by the way, I happen to be running Windows, or by the way, I happen to be running Mac OS, or by the way, I happen to be running the Linux client of this game. We were concerned about, you know, too much personal information, but we thought it was reasonable because your web browser tells everyone what operating system you're running, so we figured that probably was not offensive to tell people that. So by CD key, not by name or address or anything like that, we knew roughly who was playing on which operating system, and we knew when people jumped between operating systems because their CD key worked on all platforms. We didn't make you buy the game again if you wanted to play it on Linux. In fact, the Linux version, the installer is on the CD. So just take your Windows disk you bought at Best Buy or whatever you have around here, pop it in the machine, type linux installer.shell, and play it on Linux. It's awesome. So, but the thing is, we knew roughly that there was a certain percentage of people playing on Linux, and we found something really alarming. We found what we expected, I should start by saying, is that most people were not playing on Linux. Most people were playing on Windows. That's to be expected. You could see that in any browser stats for people surfing the web. And you got to assume that the people that are playing video games are not necessarily any more technical than my mom trying to figure out how to buy stuff off QVC.com. So, sorry, Mom, if you hear this podcast, which you won't because you don't know how to use the internet. but the point being that you don't have to be technical to play games. You have to be technical to host a server, but not to play games. So you should assume that most of these people are going to be running Windows because it's the status quo. And we found that about 2% of the people were playing it on Linux, which is, I guess that's not good, but it's probably better than we expected. The alarming thing is this. There was only 1% playing it on Mac OS. Now, which of these things, if we were to weigh Linux and Mac OS and Linux and Mac OS, which one do people call the desktop operating system?
Linux.
They should, because there's twice as many people playing on Linux than there are on Mac OS. And I have my theories for this. I think it's partially the Mac version was harder to find in the stores, and your really nice Mac might cost you $3,000, but you can put together a Linux machine from spare parts. And people in Russia, for example, could find get a Linux box up much easier. And people in China don't have Windows. I mean, I guess they do, but no one pays for it. There's a lot of factors, but the fact of the matter is, it doesn't matter what way you want to explain it away, there are more Linux desktop users than there are Mac desktop users. But one is considered by everyone from New York Times to Wired to be a serious desktop operating system, and one is not considered that. And I think that that's probably not fair because they have it backwards. Now, I like Mac OS, I have it running right here, but I think that's worth noting. But the reason I was telling you this is that the other reason, getting back to the dedicated servers, is that I have found, not so much with Unreal Tournament, because it had a Linux server right out of the box. Epic tries to have a policy that the Linux version of the server goes out before the game, because you want all the people that make their living hosting this game for other people and running game servers, you want them to be prepared the day that people can buy it off the shelves. You want people to put the disk in, install the game, load it up, see the cool, like, boom, made by EA or something, logo that everyone tries to skip and can't. And then you want them to go play a game and find 500 servers. Like, you don't want them to load up the game and find what everyone finds when there's no Linux dedicated server for the thing. You don't want them to load up the game and find out there's nobody playing it. And it's gotten to the point where commercial game companies, which is really, when you load up any game that has a multiplayer component, you see a list of servers. One or two of those guys are DSL lines, but 99% of them are professional hosting companies. And if it's only a Linux, if it's only a Windows version, they won't host the game. And we're talking about a $40 million game that tanks and fails, because a lot of games depend on that multiplayer element. We've seen places where this has worked, we've seen places where it hasn't. I don't want to name names, because some of them have been successful, some of them have not, but it does seem to be that bad games with Linux servers do well, and good games without Linux servers fail. And it's happens enough that it's statistically significant. And, you know, you've seen other things. Like, for example, the U.S. Army has a game called America's Army, and they refuse to run Windows servers for the games because they're insecure. And, it came down to not just a question of how much does the machine reboot, but also the server admins wanted to know how many copies of this game we could stack on one server. If I get a machine with 4 processors, can I run 12 copies of this game? Because the less hardware I have to buy and still be able to legitimately service my customers, the more money I make. It's important. I really didn't want to talk to you guys about dedicated service today, but I got off on a tangent. I'm going to move on. Let's see. I want to talk about tools a little bit. I don't know how long I've been talking. Is there a limit where I should shut up?
When people are all gone, it's
when people leave.
Oh, well, I'm going to keep talking for a while then. So if you want to, like, throw, you know, rotten fruit and underwear, or, like, fruit and rotten underwear or something, just let me know. You know, and we'll go from there. Okay. I'm being heckled, I think.
Too much information.
So I want to talk about tools. The one thing Loki did really well back when they were doing this is they recognized that you can't just ship a Linux game because there's so much infrastructure that just simply does not exist. For example, something that most Linux people don't consider because they've always been using apt-get or yum or... I don't know, what does Slackware use? I guess they just compile everything or type in binary code by hand.
Install package, PKG.
Oh, does that work now? Okay. Yeah. I was a hardcore Slackware user back when you had that floppies, and like you get through like 60 floppies for the X server install, and then like floppy 61 was corrupt, and you just had to weep openly.
It just untars and undoes and stuff.
Fair enough. But the point being that, you know, in terms of that, that works really well when you control the repository. That doesn't work so well when you have, say, a closed source binary blob of video game or whatnot like that, and, you know, Debian's not going to add it to their apt-get repository and stuff. So we had to talk about things like, well, how do you install closed source software on Linux? And so we wrote at Loki, we wrote an installer called Loki Setup, and we talk about things like, well, how do you get graphics to the screen? Because frankly, X11 is miserable to use. If you ever have to write, if you ever have to find yourself including the xlib header, quit, get a new job, send the resume out. It's time to move on. It's awful to work with directly. So we need better tools for that. We came up with something called SDL, Simple Direct Media Layer, which I'll talk about a little bit briefly later on. You know, in terms of sound, we were talking about. We had to write. We had developers working on OpenGL drivers back when Utah GLX was how you got 3D triangles to the screen, and it was all open source, which was a nice change from what it is now. We we had developers working on that, and we also did something really interesting called OpenAL, which has taken off, and I'll talk about that very briefly here. Everyone thinks about 3D video and says, okay. Whether it's Direct3D or OpenGL, you always end up with some library that says, here's a bunch of triangles, put them to the screen and figure it out for me because it's really slow if I have to do this on the CPU. And back when people were doing 2D games, the reason they were doing 2D games is because you had to touch every single pixel on the screen that you wanted to light up. And at the low level, that came down to a buffer of memory. You knew that when you wrote this value here, it would make that pixel red, but sooner or later, your processor was working on every single pixel on the screen, every frame, and hardware for video screens was getting better, and resolutions were going up. And as the resolution goes up, you have more pixels to touch every frame. And by the time you have a 1024 by 768 frame, you find out that you're touching like more than a megabyte of data every frame just to draw to the screen, and it gets worse and worse and worse. So eventually it got to the point where someone smart out there, probably 3DFX or whatever with their Voodoo card, said, well, why don't you just tell us generally what you want, specifically like triangles, and we'll figure out which pixels to light up for you. And the video card does that while you start working on the next frame of the game, whatever. You know, you're moving characters around while the video card's churning on which pixels it should light up. And that has worked well for many years, and it's moving on to the point where video cards now are literally little computers in themselves. You can write something for a video card called a shader, which is quite literally, you write mostly like a C program for the video card now. And that C program is running in parallel to whatever you're doing. And that's the only way you can get the frame rates you get with the beautiful effects you get in things like, you know, Unreal Tournament 3 and such, is that it's literally two computers running in parallel. Nothing like this has ever happened for audio before. In fact, I think you'll find that most audio software that you can... audio libraries, things that talk to the audio card, suck. There's really no nice way to say it. There's no way to talk about things like surround sound, generally, unless you want to push to each channel the same way that you would push to each pixel on the video screen. And if you wanted to do things that were, you know, fancy, like I'm standing here in the game, but I want the sound to sound like it's coming from over there somewhere, you had to actually do the attenuation and the panning and all sorts of complex mathematics to figure out what should that sound like when it's over there, and which bytes should I be pushing to the sound card to make that happen. Nothing ever really existed before that did for the audio card what OpenGL and Direct3D did for the video card. So Loki spent quite a bit of resources on something called OpenAM, the Open Audio Library, or Audio Layer, depending on who you ask. And they worked with Creative Labs, which is a sound card company, if you haven't heard of them, and probably in a few years you won't. But but at the time, they had really, really awesome sound, and people were still thinking about sound cards that it's only a matter of time before they become like the video cards, where their own little computer. So Loki developed an API for this called OpenAL with Creative, and we started using it in all our Linux games. And we had an open source OpenAL thing, which did all that hard math for you. And since really all you had was kind of just a dumb digital signal processor on the card, it figured out which buttons you should be pushing like they were pixels, and that worked out. And life went on from there with it. But we found some interesting things have happened. One, OpenAL, for those of you with the MacBooks out, if you look, it's a system framework in macOS now. You can write an OpenAL thing, and it will work on Linux and macOS. The other interesting thing is that if anyone's had the misfortune to use Windows Vista, there used to be something called DirectSound 3D, which was a lot of what I was talking about with, you know, having a second computer that is your sound card. Vista took that out. If you paid $300 for the really nice sound card, sucker, then you can't use it anymore in Vista. It's just the same as the crappy onboard thing that you get, you know, in your beige box computer. So Creative Labs did the only sensible thing. They said, okay, we're writing hardware drivers, because you can write drivers for things that aren't, you know, system-level Windows things. If you have a piece of hardware no one's heard of and doesn't work like anything you've heard of before, you can write a driver for it. So they wrote OpenAL drivers for all their hardware and said, okay, all these games that used to have nice hardware acceleration for the audio card that worked in Windows XP and no longer works in Vista can now use OpenAL. And suddenly, this little API that this little company that no one's ever heard of for Linux is now becoming the standard for PC development in terms of Windows and Linux and Mac OS. And your source code just generally works on all three platforms in terms of audio stuff. We had to make patches to Unreal Tournament 2003 because they use OpenAL. And they're all Windows developers before I got there. And there was one patch, the header had a slash instead of a backslash. But other than that, it was entirely just worked out of the box. So that's a huge win. We have this really portable, nice, clean API that has all the things you like from OpenGL. It really meshed really nicely with OpenGL. Like, you could just use the same data. They had the same 3D coordinate space. And it just worked on all three platforms once you wrote the software. So it was a huge win. SDL is something called Simple Direct Media Layer. For those of you, I don't know if it's too late. I think the application thing might have just closed. It's a Google Summer of Code project this year. So if you're bored, you're looking for something to do, we'd love your help. Windows has something called DirectX, which is like how to talk to sound cards, and how to talk to video cards, and how to talk to joysticks. And SDL does that for a lot of platforms, not just for Linux, although that is really in many ways our primary development thing. But it gives you a nice, very, very simple way to talk to all the hardware you would need if you're a game developer. And it has nice little add-on libraries. If you don't really want to screw around with networking, they have a simple networking layer. And if you don't really want to screw around with audio mixing, they have a nice little mixer set up and stuff like that. But the thing has been ported to so many platforms, it's almost embarrassing. There is, every now and then you'll see, like, a news article about, like, you know, Quake 2 now running on Pocket PC, or, you know, I don't know if anyone saw the Quake 3 running on the iPhone videos the other day. I think they're a hoax. But if they're not, they're using SDL, because SDL has gotten to the point where it's very easy to bring up on a new platform. It runs on everything. We have an iPod version of it. I'm talking like iPod Linux, the little black and white iPods. It'll run on that. It'll run on OS 2, BIOS, Linux, Windows, Mac OS, Mac OS 9.
Amiga?
It does have an Amiga port. I'm not kidding. Your toaster, you know, it'll run on your microwave. Anywhere that you can compile this thing, it's probably already got a port, because anytime people people do homebrew development, this is their first stop nowadays, because let's say you want to do what everyone does. You get a new piece of hardware that has a video screen on it. The first thing you want to play on is Maniac Mansion.
Yep.
If not the original Doom. You know, something like that. And there's an open source thing called ScumVM, which does emulation for all those old cool, old LucasArts games like Maniac Mansion and Day of the Tentacle and Full Throttle and stuff like that. And it uses SDL. And every time you see something like, you know, homebrew now running on the Nintendo Wii, or, you know, now homebrew now running on the Xbox 360, it's always using SDL. So it's become a huge success, and it's hit this critical mass of both users and developers. And chances are, if you need to get a game running on a system you've never heard of before, your first stop is SDL. We're in the process of upgrading this and doing, and, you know, cleaning up some limitations of it. For example, a lot of SDL development was based on what Loki needed at the time. And what they needed at the time was a way to say, you know, give us, you know, change the resolution of the monitor and go. But there aren't any video games that use more than one window. You know, whether they're full screen or not, it's always just one window. But people are starting to use it for things. They're like, well, we want to build, like, a GTK port so we can have multiple windows and just, it'll just run on anything SDL does. So if you're using SDL as the back end, so, or, you know, you want to make a web browser that runs on, I don't know, a Nokia phone or something like that. These things make it easier, but we're starting to run into things where, you know, people want to use it for regular application development instead of just video games. So we're starting to remove limitations like only having one window, or, you know, we want to make it so you can talk to multiple sound cards, because everyone is starting to find out they have more than one sound card and don't know it. You have the thing that's built into your machine, and you can plug in a USB one. And that's interesting for one reason and one reason only. If you're playing a multiplayer game, it's good to get the sound of the game and then be able to talk to your teammates separately. So it's cool if you can control multiple. Seriously, I mean, it's, you know, there's a value in that. So we're starting to add those things to SDL. And it's a Google Summer of Code project this year. So we're hoping to get a lot of really cool and insane things, because that's really what Google Summer of Code promises to give you. And I'm down with that. Let's see. What else? Should I give you the negative part of the talk? All right, I'll give you the negative part. Why not? This part's called Don't Celebrate Yet.
Oh, I thought that part was going to be titled IKEA.
Oh, man. Should we talk about that really quickly? I don't know. Don't celebrate yet. Everyone that makes video hardware today behaves badly, but that is starting to change. Anyone that's done 3D stuff on a laptop recently has probably used an NVIDIA card, because their drivers are closed source, but generally speaking, they work really well, and they're optimized, and NVIDIA did the same thing I was talking about with that Dream Team programming thing, where you have your Linux user and your Windows user working in parallel. The NVIDIA driver source code for their video cards, with the exception of the parts that are Windows-specific or X11-specific, it's exactly the same code base. So, naturally, since they work really well on Windows, they also work really well on Linux, because they're sharing 98% of the code between the two. The problem is, the code they're sharing is closed source, and we're getting to the point where people are going, you know, we'll swallow a closed source program if it's, say, a video game, because you can live without it. But if they stop supporting your video card, you can't live without your video card unless, you know, you've developed ESP or something. And the problem is, once one person gets away with acting badly, everyone acts badly. So ATI, who used to give out both source code and specifications for how to talk to their hardware, stopped doing both. Intel started doing this as well. But the good news is that is actually starting to change now, because we have ATI is now bought by AMD, which actually I think has turned out really well, because now they're starting to give out specifications. So like, kerchunk, here's 1,600 pages of how to talk to the 2D parts of the card. Can you imagine what kind of encyclopedia the 3D parts are going to be? But nonetheless, I mean, as soon as you do that, there's a million willing hackers, or maybe two or three of them, out on the internet that go, talking to video hardware is probably not something, you're not going to be like, oh, I'm a Visual Basic developer, I'm totally going to write this kernel driver. You know? But somebody will be talented for that, and whether they have a financial reason or not, sometimes things get done just because it gives them a Woody. And, you know, someone out there is going to write that NVIDIA driver as soon as there's specifications on how to talk to the hardware. So ATI is starting to give out specifications, but not necessarily source code. Intel, who who doesn't have exactly the best video chip, but they do have a 3D video chip, not only is giving out specifications for how to talk to the hardware, they're giving out source code, and they're paying companies to write X11 drivers for it as open source. So this is a sea change. This is really not something we have seen in a long time. I mean, if you're old enough, you bought your computer and came with a manual for how to talk to all the obscure little pieces of hardware. But this is really, in a modern day and age where everyone's a little nervous about intellectual property, this is really a wildly new thing to see video card people doing. And it's brave of them to do it, too.
Let me interrupt just a second before some people stop in here. You need to go to the bathroom. It's down the hall. Have you announced that? It's down the hall through the doors, and put a business card in the lock.
No, it's unlocked.
It's unlocked?
It's unlocked. It must be opted.
All right. Well, I got stuck in there last week. And I knocked 15 minutes. Nobody came. I thought everybody had left.
Is that who you're talking about?
Just in case you check, put a business card in there.
If you don't come back, we'll come for you.
That was your moment of sadness.
That's important. Just check his lock. So he heard me say that. So he put a business card in there.
See, if you wait a few more minutes, this could have been funny. So that's okay.
After you stepped out of the room, Rick had a better suggestion. He said, put your Visa card in it.
Oh, my goodness. So that is actually changing. The video card thing is changing. And it's part of a question of just financial pressure, which is a point I was getting to, is that sooner or later, in terms of, we'll skip Don't Celebrate Yet. Let's just keep this light and happy. Right?
Yeah.
Just a second, though. I mean, since you've had interaction with some of these companies, or at least I've perceived that,
mm-hmm.
I used to buy ATI hardware mm-hmm. because they released it.
Yeah.
How do you communicate that to the company so they know that there's people out there who are buying their stuff because they're being good?
Well, I think that mostly you should just go to a random forum and complain. No, I'm just kidding. That's what everyone does. It doesn't work. I think that...
Is there something that's a thing?
Yes. Petitions online are not. Email to the right people is. And sometimes that it's just email to, anything you can find, just to flood them. If it's one person bitching, it doesn't help. It never helps. And, people going, well, I'm going to take my money somewhere else. That doesn't help. But for those of you that have ever heard Alice's Restaurant, when two people do it, it's a conspiracy. When three people do it, it's a movement. You do it enough. If enough different people are showing up going, hey, guess what I'm buying? Not your product. Then they start to go, oh, wait a minute. And I think that's partially what's happening, is that Linux as a desktop thing is starting to take off. And
you said email to the right people. So what...
It helps to know the right people. You'd be surprised. Find any email address you can find on their website. Generally, it will make it to the right people if it gets sent in enough volume. Now, it helps to know the right person sometimes, but we'll get to that too. But as far as it goes, sometimes it's a lucky accident too. The reason you have NVIDIA drivers at all, I've been told, I don't know if this is true in fact, but this is what's been told to me, is that the guys doing Lord of the Rings, the movie, Weta, something like that is the name of them. They do all their work, and it's all their stuff is OpenGL based, like all the real workstation industry stuff is. And someone out there at one point, some tipping point tipped, and they realized that why are they paying $10,000 per workstation for these customized graphics things? We need to pay $200 at Best Buy for a video card that's almost as good. Now, if you stack a couple of those up, then you're really saving a lot of money. So with that in mind, you start having something like the Lord of the Rings people and a few other things like DreamWorks and Pixar start to talk to NVIDIA and say, by the way, we don't want to pay that Windows license because for all the reasons I said with the dedicated server people, but also there's a little bit of tech snobbery, a little bit of arrogance, The Linux people, using Windows kind of offends their techie soul a little bit, you know what I'm saying? So they don't want to use Windows. They want a Linux version. And when enough of those big industry companies talk to NVIDIA, they go, okay, we'll do a Linux driver. And then they saw they could leverage it with desktop Linux, too. But that's the first step. That's just the tipping point. From there, you got to push that boulder down the damn hill and, get the customers, you and you and you and you and you and everyone in this room, needs to start saying that my money goes to you because you act well. And if you behave badly, my money goes elsewhere. So I don't know if I answered your question or not, but...
That's more than I could have thought.
Okay, fair enough. I think it is less so. I had dinner with the vice president of development of a product called Windows once, just by luck and accident. And I had mentioned something about Linux to him during dinner, and, you know, you want the conversation to stay polite because they can have people killed. They have the money. But he said to me that the fundamental problem with Linux is that Linux users don't respect intellectual property, which is bullpucky. You know, I mean, not everyone likes the GPL, but, you know, I think that there's plenty of document evidence of people saying that intellectual property is very, very important. Everything from the SCO fiasco, where the fact that every commit that goes into the Linux kernel has a signed-off byline saying, we really wrote this. You know, this is not stolen. It's very important to us that, you know, we want to share code because that's what the GPL is about, but it's very important to us that everyone plays by the rules that were established ahead of time. To set Linux people up as thieves is, frankly, kind of offensive, but that's their mentality at the top. And, you know, as Upton Sinclair famously said, that you can't change someone's mind about something that when they're paid to have a specific opinion. So I don't think that the Windows people are ever going to change their mind about that. But those things have bled out to other companies. And this is decades of setup in that, you know, everything from Bill Gates writing that letter to the Altair enthusiast community saying you're pirating our software, that's our money that you're stealing from us to push these bits around without paying us, to what that's become in DOS and Windows and closed source, and that whole mentality that's built not just from Microsoft. I don't want to blame Microsoft, although, frankly, it's pretty easy to blame them. But they're certainly not the only ones guilty of that. But that is such an ingrained mentality. It's like, you know, an ink. It's like a pen bleeding in your pocket, much like this one did, if you can see the ink on my pants. It doesn't ever come out. And to a certain degree, you can change the minds of those people at the edges. You can fade that ink a little bit. Like, you can talk to NVIDIA, and you can change ATI's mind, but you can't... Some goals are probably unattainable. Like, you're never going to see the source code in Windows except for that little leak, you know, things like that. But then again, I never thought that the source code to Second Life would be released and be released under the GPL. How many people have heard about this? No one? Okay, Second Life is a game. It's like... a 3D thing. It's a massively multiplayer thing. It's not really a game like a game, but it's like a community, a 3D community. And they realized, the people that were developing this, this company called Linden Lab in San Francisco, that don't really have that many people, and they have some good funding, but they're not taking over the world or anything. They realized there's really nothing in the source code that, you know, is that secret in terms of intellectual property. So why not give it out? You know, who knows what you're going to get from that? And they run it, not only did they release it, I think they released it under the GPL, if I'm correct about that.
Yeah, they did.
Yes, okay, thank you. And it's remarkable that, you know, they might get one or two patches. In the same way the Mozilla source code, when it first got released, they might get a couple of patches, but mostly it's their own people working on it. But over time, you're getting a lot of value out of that for just giving up a little bit of control. But really, they're still in charge of it. It makes a lot of sense, is what I'm saying. Anyway, I'm going to move on because I'm kind of rambling here. I wanted to say very quickly that if anyone ever listened to Howard Stern back in the 90s, it's okay, I did too. But IBM did the smartest thing I've ever seen. They gave Howard Stern an IBM laptop, and they installed OS 2 on it. And every now and then, he'd be doing his ridiculous radio show, and you'd hear, like, ding, it was like a system bell from OS 2. And you go, have I heard that before? Yeah. Yeah. And every now and then, he'd be like, I hate this Windows crap. That stuff crashes. A lot of times, it was Windows 3.1 at the time, which really did crash all the time. You found Zen while rebooting if you used Windows 3.1. But he would talk, he would go on for these rants about how his computers always crashed before he had OS 2. And I don't know if he was paid for that. It might have just been he liked his laptop. But I'm thinking, there might be a value to this. Can we get Oprah Winfrey using Ubuntu? So I'm saying that I think we need to make this a little more sexy, I think is where we're going here. If we're talking about next steps for things, I think that we need to find a way to stop talking about Linux user groups. I love you all very much. But this is very contained. These are aficionados. These are fans. These are enthusiasts. But we need to find a way to get my mother, who doesn't understand anything except that you can buy stuff from QVC on the internet now, which is, like, you know, amazing for her. We need to get her to the point where using Linux is cool for her. Without, and the way you do that is by not having her know she's using Linux, because she doesn't know she's using Mac OS right now. She thinks she's using the lamp. She has an iMac, one of those lamp-looking ones. She's using something called Avium, which is an instant message program for Mac OS, which has a logo of a duck. I don't know if anyone's ever seen this. She doesn't know what instant messaging is. She calls that the duck. Every now and then it cracks when someone sends her a message. But I think that moving forward with Linux, and you have to get to that point where people use Windows because it's there. It's not that they've learned it. It's not that they have any expertise in Windows for the most part. But it's what's always been on their machine. So if you can get some more installed, and as much as I dislike Walmart, there was that talk that there were Linspire machines coming out of Walmart for, like, what was it, like $200 or something ridiculous like that. But I think the ways in there is you have to have the very simple install, the very simple user interface. And I think we're making progress on this. And I know everyone says that every year that we're making progress on that, but I really do. I think that, you know, we're at the point where, as much as we complained for years, I was surprised to find Ubuntu knew how to talk to my printer right away, and Fedora, and pick your favorite distro here, whatever. But and that, you know, it could just find my Wi-Fi card, and it just worked. And these things that you don't want to have to apologize for later are just starting to work now. And it's starting to be because, you know, one laptop per child is doing work on it. And there might be financing for that, but that work benefits everyone eventually. And making things easier benefits everyone, even though Canonical mostly sooner or later just wants to sell you Ubuntu support or Ubuntu CD. The fact that they're making it easier benefits Fedora and Mandrake and SUSE and all those other things. And the other thing on top of that, which is why I'm here today, is because I spent all this time making video games, but I think this is the most important thing, is that most people that use their systems do a couple of things. They check email, they surf the web, maybe they have instant message, and they play video games. So I think in terms of evangelism, the best thing you can do is get more Linux gamers, which means you need more Linux games. Which brings me back to my original point, that you are actually all video game developers, and you just don't know it. It's good for the soul to write Tetris. It's fairly simple to do. I'm not going to do it for you right now because it's not that simple that I can wave my hands like I've been doing.
But next month in the shell scripting class,
you can use SDL for it. So. There's a lot of value in writing video games, even very simple ones, and getting people excited about this. I read in the newspaper yesterday that the AP board, you know, the guys that give you college credit for high school classes, you know what I'm talking about? They're dropping computer science. It is no longer in the curriculum because they don't have enough people signing up for it. There's going to be a value not just in writing video games and very simple ones and learning very basic techniques of video game development, but teaching these to other people. If you could do something of value, and even if you end up doing this on Windows, it's not giving someone a Linux CD that's valuable. What's that phrase about teaching someone to fish? The best thing you can do if you're a programmer is teach someone else how to program. And the best thing you can do if you have a little bit of game experience is teach someone else a little bit about games. Because the very basics are very simple in terms of, you know, keep track of a timer, make sure you check input once a frame. You know, the little basic things that you find out. The best thing that you can do is make people excited to play games. The best thing you can do is make people excited to build games. In terms of Tetris, in terms of Turtle Graphics and logo and moving, you know, a line around the screen. It's really infectious, and I think a lot of people that are programmers stumbled into it at an early age. You know, whether it was assembly language or a Perl script or QBasic.com on their DOS machine or whatnot, which I loved. Teaching someone to program, I think, is the best thing you could ever, ever do. Because I found that the good programmers are attracted to good technology, which it's not Linux that they like, it's good technology they like. It's not an accident that they're going to Linux, though. So I think in terms of what we're talking about here, I know I'm here talking about video games, but the first step before you do anything else is indoctrinate everyone you can. Teach them how to program. Teach them how to enable them to create. That's the most important thing. If I could pick something out, I'm trying to think of the best way to say that, and I think I might have, so I'm going to stop saying it. But the best thing you can do is stop evangelizing and start teaching, I think, because there's really a dearth of it, and if you're expecting someone else to do it, it won't happen. And for those of you that grew up in the 80s and the 90s, when there were Mac classics, way before they were even like color, they were like black and white screens, or you had a green Apple II computer playing Karateka or something. This was the introduction to so many programmers in their lives. And Commodore 64 is playing Pitfall and Ghostbusters and, you know, games like that that were, by modern terms, simple, but still at the time a thing of magic. You don't have to write Half-Life 2 to get that feel for, oh my god, I'm creating something and it's really neat. You know, it could be Zork. It could be simpler than Zork. It could be a three-room little dungeon, you know, or whatnot like that. I think that the best thing you could be doing is teaching people in whatever form you can to create stuff. And magically, those people seem to drift towards Linux once they get that bug. So I guess if I could tell you to do one thing, it's not be docile. It's to mentor. It's to, teach people to fish. So anyway, I think that's my talk. I've probably worn out my welcome here, so I'm going to say thank you. If anyone has any questions, throw stuff at me. Yes?
Developing the game and all the source code that you've amassed,
mm-hmm.
How much code, how many brick walls do you run into the operating systems, and how much upstream code you kept pushing up to upstream programmers to fix stuff?
I don't get a lot of time with original developers, and ironically, the games they send me almost never even compile on Windows when they send it to me. You're laughing, but if any of you work in a commercial closed-source environment, as an experiment, go install Windows or Linux or whatever you use to build your program. Go install a clean install of the operating system, put just enough on there to build the thing like the compiler, Visual Studio, or whatever you need, and try to compile it. 9 times out of 10, it won't work. Because there's a library that they just, or a tool they assume is going to be on the system and it's not in a clean install of Windows, or there's that magic library that only builds on John's machine or whatnot like that. So, the only game in recent history I've tried that is actually compiled not only on Windows, but with the free compiler you can download from Microsoft, is Call of Duty 4. And I got to tell you, it's been like probably 5 years between that point and the last time I had a game that compiled on Windows. So in terms of upstream, I don't get a lot of upstream contact. I don't want it. It slows me down. It pisses them off. A lot of times at these games, I'm getting it when they're going on vacation because they've been in crunch mode for 6 months to a year. They don't want to talk to me. They want it done. And, you know. So if there is a good fix, this was something I was going to say about tools. There's a program called Valgrind, or Valgrind, depending on how you pronounce it. I don't know if you've ever used this. It is the holy grail of game development. And the holy grail of development in general, too, is that it fundamentally runs whatever program you give it, whether it's Hello World or Serious Sam 2, it will run it in a virtual machine, in a little emulator of the x86 processor, and it will look at every read and write access to memory. And it runs really slow. Like, it runs maybe 30 times slower than the program normally would, but it finds every single bug in everything. And you'd be surprised the number of bugs that are just simply not crashing Windows that thing finds out. And it only runs on Linux, so even if you have a Windows product, game or otherwise, it's worth having that Linux port just so you can run under Valgrind. Because it'll find you bugs, even if you never ship that Linux version, it will find you things that will save your butt on Windows. Because it's not crashing now, but it's going to crash the next when Service Pack 3 comes out, and the memory manager changes where it puts stuff. One game I had a fun bug where they cast a pointer to an integer, and sometimes, depending on where in memory that pointer ended up, it would become negative, and then they'd lose a bit, and then you're crashing. Happened on Windows, too, and they couldn't understand why it was only like on Service Pack 2 machines that it would crash. But it crashed every time on Linux, so I had to fix it, and they were happy to have the fix. But I do send those fixes in, but for the most part, I consider that a very important part of my job. I don't know if they're thinking about that, but this gets back to my dream team thing, is that those bugs get found like that if you're doing it all along. At the end, it's like, oh, well, that's egg on our face. But some games are easier to port than others. one of the things that I thought was really, really important was to stop chasing games, individual games, because it's a losing battle. There's always something cool and new coming out, and you're never, ever going to get them all. There's not enough hours in the day, even if you had access to all the source code and could sign all the deals for it and stuff. But one thing we found was really useful, and when I say we, I mean me, but, you know, when you work in any business and you're one person, you start to talk plurally about yourself so you sound more legitimate. So I really am not schizophrenic when I say we. It's just force of habit. Unreal Tournament 2003 was nice to have on Linux, but what I really wanted there was the Unreal Engine. Because Epic is really doing incredibly well in the game industry right now with the Unreal Engine. And it's nice that you get a single game, but if you get the engine portable, there are 15 licensees that are shipping 15 AAA titles in the next year, all have a Linux code base they can start with. Now, they're going to break things. They always do. But when you're talking about, you can guarantee the first million lines of C++ code all work on Linux. Everything after that's pretty easy. So I spent some time, the Unreal Engine now works, the Doom Engine, which id Software has a guy that works full-time on Linux stuff, that works. If you were to build something on Half-Life 2, enough of it works that you can get the dedicated server, so it's a step up from there. A number of other engines. The engines are much, much more important than the games themselves, because it means if you get the engine, you can get God knows how many more games. And we saw this with Unreal Engine 2, because you know, there was everything from Postal to America's Army to on the Mac they got Splinter Cell, on the Mac they got you know, the Harry Potter games and stuff like that. These things became possible as soon as the engine was portable to more than just Linux, to all sorts of operating systems. And now you can see with the Xbox and the Xbox 360 and the PS3 is that having that portability opens up markets for their licensees. Right now, somewhere in Japan, there's an arcade that has an arcade machine that's running inside a PC motherboard with an NVIDIA card, and it's running a Linux version of Unreal to do some not Unreal Tournament, but some game based on the Unreal Engine. And the reason they could do that is because the Linux version worked out of the box, because Epic had taken the time on it. Now, the irony is that actually makes Epic money, too. Even if they never make a single dollar from selling a Linux version of Unreal Tournament 2004, they now have licensees coming to them and saying, oh, you know, this engine, which costs, I don't know, several hundred thousand dollars, we picked you instead of them because you have a Linux version. You know, I mean, now it doesn't matter how many copies of Unreal Tournament they sold on Linux, because they've more than made their money up at that point. You know, all you need is one licensee. If you get two or three, you know, you're rolling in dough that your competitors couldn't do because, you know, they didn't have the foresight. So that's very, very important. I'm not even sure what the original question was. I got off on a rant. So I'm going to assume it was answered. questions?
Any idea why the U.S. Army discontinued the Linux version of Army Ops?
Yes, next question. it's complicated. There was, like all things Army, there was a lot of politics involved.
Democrats.
Actually, ironically, Republicans. No, I mean, well, you're laughing, but I mean, I don't want to get too political here. I didn't wear my Barack Obama shirt today or anything, but I don't know why decisions get made in the Army, and I'm not going to pretend I do, but I do know for a fact that we're doing this thing called the Iraq War right now, and it costs a lot of money. So the military looks at their budget and goes, well, what can we cut? Hey, we're making a video game. What the heck, yo? So they started looking for things they could, places they could trim money from it. So the Linux dedicated server is still important. The current version of America's Army still runs on Linux. They just don't keep it out anymore because they're only focusing on the dedicated server because they need it under their reduced financial budget. So, I mean, I don't have any dirty laundry like Oprah story. I'm not going to, like, cry on your shoulder. It's just, you know, it's not that interesting of a story. It's just budgetary things. And I don't want to blame the Republicans, but, you know, they started the damn war, so. All right. Any other questions? Now that I've offended all the Republicans in the room. But really, you guys started the war. It's not cool.
You said you were going to possibly talk about where your name Iculus came from.
Oh, I was hoping to avoid that. It's not that exciting. Has anyone ever heard of a band called Fish with a P-H? They have the guy that was the lead singer, they're not together anymore, they broke up, which made every weed-smoking hippie on the planet, really sad. But they have they had a... the lead singer of that did a concept album for his senior project at college called The Man Who Stepped Into Yesterday. And it's got all these different characters that are involved in this plot. But one of the characters is a guy named Iculus, and he's the great and wise prophet on the mountaintop that holds the helping friendly book and has help for people and stuff. But without getting into too much detail, if that's not too late already, when I went to work at Loki, they told us that we needed to have an email address and a login for the network that was a mythical creature. And we had a guy named Hercules was one of the login names. There's a Highlander was the boss because there can be only one, I guess. But I went in there and I was new and scared and intimidated because I was writing crappy, customer relation management software in Java before I got hired to be a rock star video game developer. I should probably say before I go on that there is no such thing as a rock star video game developer. Everyone that's into video games thinks they're going to get this job and it's going to be like this Hollywood awesome thing and you're going to go to like parties and people are going to be like, what do you do? And you're going to say, I'm a video game developer. Would you like to go for a ride with me in my cherry red Ferrari? It just doesn't work that way. But, I was intimidated like everyone is when they're really young. And so I go in there and they're like, well, what do you want for a login name? And I said, well, just something like Gordon R. or R. Gordon or something. I think this is what I was probably using on my own box at the time because I'm boring. But they told me that wasn't interesting enough. I needed to pick a mythical creature. So being a fish fan, as I was and am, they... Iculus was the first thing that came to mind. Sometimes you make decisions under duress, pick a username, and it sticks with you for the rest of your life. So if I can give you some advice, do you think Richard Stallman, if he had thought about it, would he have gone with RMS? He would have picked something cool. He would have been like Hellbringer or something like that. But someone probably was like, what do you want on the MIT AI system? And he's like, I guess just RMS. And now he's stuck with it. So, if I could give you all some advice today, pick a cool name. Think about it now. The time will come when you have to tell someone. But be ready. And change it up as you go along. Because, things that were cool in the 80s, like if you called yourself Voltron now, people would probably think you're a loser. So that's the Iculus thing. The thing that I found really remarkable is that Linux users, when I get introduced at talks and stuff, call me Iculus. Mac users call me Ryan. I'm not sure what this means exactly, but it creeps me out because it happens every time. I don't know. I think that the Linux people, my explanation is that the Macs tend to be a bit more business because that's really, they want legitimacy and that's a mistake. Who needs that? But I think the Linux people still just have a little bit more fantasy in their minds. They have a little bit more, they haven't lost their childhood innocence to a certain degree. Do you know what I mean? Like, everyone in this room still kind of hopes there's fire-breathing dragons out there somewhere, and that they're awesome. And by the way, they are awesome. But so I think that to a degree, people like the idea of mythical superheroes. Not that I think of myself as one, but just having a handle that sounds like, a Greek something, Greek god or something like that. I think that people like to associate with that. Like, it lets you escape a little bit from the real world. In just a very small, tiny way. And I think there's a huge value to that. So I don't want to make fun of Linux users for referring to me as Iculus, but really, my mom is mad at you all. She's very happy about the name she picked out for me. Anyway, so I don't know if that answered your question. Any other questions? Anything I can...
Are you...
It's just this one guy. I'm ignoring you. I'm sorry. We'll get to it.
Are you all at all being tapped to move Picasa by Google?
No. Picasa uses Wine.
Yes, which is why it would be nice to have a real port.
I'm with you on that one, but there's two schools of thought in there. The guy who spearheaded the Picasa effort at Google is a Wine contributor, and I don't want to diss on Wine because it has its merits, but it just never works for me. But I guess if you're going to tailor it to one application, that would be cool. But... it's just simply two schools of thought. And I think it's interesting. I think it's, to a certain degree, hedging your bets. Because they did the Google Earth port natively, and they did Picasa using Wine. And I think that over time, my hope is, because I'm a little arrogant, and I worked on Google Earth and not Picasa. I'm a little arrogant. I kind of want the Picasa one to fail a little bit. I don't actually want to fail. But I want people to say, we're not getting as good of a product out of this. And if you're going to start doing things with wine, you start to have to worry about, like, what happens when you hit the file dialog, but you hit the open menu item, and the file dialog talks about the C drive. What the hell's a C drive on Linux? It doesn't exist. It was a bad idea on Windows, too, but they're stuck with it. And, you know, I think to a degree you can work around those things in, if not in wine generally, but in wine targeted at Picasa or wine targeted at, I don't know, The Sims or something like that. You can work around that to a degree, but I don't know. It just seems like a lot of times you're not, you get an inferior product. And Mac people have been famous for this for years. The worst insult you could ever give to a Mac program is that it looks like a bad port of the Windows version. And I think that's true, too. I think you could probably have said that about WordPerfect on Linux. I mean, Linux has a little bit of a benefit that it has identity issues and that nothing looks like a Linux program. I mean, and if something does look like a Linux program, next year it's not, because the GTK theme's going to change or something like that, or the KDE theme, or the WX Widgets theme, or, you know, the TK theme, which hasn't been updated in a million years. To a degree, that helps. But it's the insult still applies. If it looks like a bad port of a Windows version, then you're not really getting value as a user or as a customer. And
like a good port of a Windows program, but not getting
good. There are some good Windows programs. I mean, we have to be fair. There are some out there that's like, boy, and this is where we get to Google Earth, is that there are. Do you something?
Well, I just wondered. I just wanted your opinion of trans gaming Sudoku equally moderate.
I'm going to dovetail into that in 1 second. For those that don't know, there's a company called Trans Gaming that does a commercial version of wine that's specifically targeted at gaming called Sudoku, and we'll talk about that in a moment. Part of the problem is that there are actually good Windows programs. Windows itself has even gotten better. I don't think it will ever be that good, because partially it has so much legacy crap that it can't escape. It just can't. And for those of you that have been reading the news where they're talking about Windows 7 and they're going to run all the old Windows programs in a virtual machine, good luck with that. You know, it's just that worked out great for Mac OS too, so we'll see how that goes for you. Because really, no one's updating that program they wrote for Windows 95. That's always going to run that virtual machine. And you'd be surprised to find there is still 16-bit Windows code that people run every day and don't know it's 16-bit. And usually it's an installer. And so it's like you're locked out from even starting. You can't get your program installed anymore on, say, Win64, which doesn't have Win16 support anymore. What was I going to say? But there are good Windows programs. And the example that I have here, it's like there's Internet Explorer is a piece of crap. But, you know, in terms of web browsers, there's a good equivalent on Linux with Firefox. And there's, you know, word processors like Microsoft Word are important, but there are good equivalents like OpenOffice if you have 8 gigs of RAM and stuff like that. But there are not just like crappy clones, but legitimate competitors out there. There is no such thing for Google Earth, and there's the NASA thing. What is it called? I don't know. There is something that's an open source thing, but it's just not even close to competitive with Google Earth. And it occurred to me. I got very lucky. Google called me and asked if I wanted to do it, but I was trying to find an address at Google I could write to and be like, I will come in and sleep under a desk and port this for free, because it's actually at the point where it's holding Linux back to not have this. It's so important, because there's nothing like it out there. And, you know, you can always be like, well, okay, you have this, but we have Firefox, and you have this, but we have OpenOffice, but you have Google Earth, and we have chirp, 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 chirp. There's nothing out there like it. And I was reading news reports, NPR releases from Google, where they're talking about Hurricane Katrina hit and devastated New Orleans, and they were using Google Earth to find people and saying, like, okay, we need to get to this exact coordinate. Try to find the houses in Google Map by their rooftops and pick people up off the rooftops. And it worked, and it saved lives. Why the hell can't we have that on Linux? Why do we have to run Windows to make the world a better place? So, I'm not kidding. Why, you know, what? When it comes down to it, it's not just like, oh, man, they got some bullet points on us there. It's like, this is literally a question of making humanity suck a little less. And I wanted to see that there. So I just, in terms of that, there are good Windows programs, and those have to make it to Linux. And Google Earth was an example of that. So Picasa, I think, is a little less so because, frankly, I think the GIMP is better. Picasa's more focused at, like...
organization?
Yeah, the GIMP is more focused at the Photoshop users. Picasa's more focused at, you know... yeah, less expertise, you know. Like, my mom could use Picasa more than she could use Photoshop or the GIMP or something. I think they also looked at it and said, you know, in terms of cost, what's it going to cost to take this complete code base and make it work on Linux? And Google Earth was using Qt, the graphical toolkit, the GUI toolkit, on Windows, even before I showed up, and on Mac. And that's how they got their Mac port originally. And they're using something called Alchemy for the rendering, which it's like SDL, and it's been ported to everything. And there's a PSP version and a PlayStation version, Xbox version, and blah, 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 and an OpenGL render, which is how they got the Mac version. So those things were in place, and we could do the Linux version much easier of Google Earth because they made a lot of really good portability decisions before they showed up. I haven't seen the Picasa code base, but my understanding is that those portability decisions weren't there, so Wine was the path of least resistance for it. I don't know if that's true. It might have just been religion. There's a lot of religion and a lot of technical decisions, and you know, that's just how that goes. As far as transgaming goes, I was a subscriber for 1 week, and I couldn't find a single game I owned that it would run. And I was trying to run things that they don't have in their compatibility database. It's like, ooh, Puzzle Quest, you know, I love this game. That game is awesome, by the way. I want a port of it. But, you know, things that were non-standard. But the problem is, if it doesn't run the thing, and this is true of Wine, too, and the transgaming people are some of the smartest people you'll ever meet. Technically speaking, they are geniuses. It's a big pile of genius. And what they do is a very hard thing to do well. But if it's just not going to work on, if it's only going to work on 5 Windows games that everyone plays, is it really worth it for the man years that you have to put into this thing in development? I mean, Wine is not at a 1.0 release yet, and it started out as something that was supposed to run 16-bit Windows applications. That's a generation that ended a while ago. The 32-bit generation is about to end. And we're still not at a 1.0 for this. So I'm questioning, oh, and also the Windows API is a moving target. And also, do you really want to marry yourself to Windows? Why not just run Windows then? I mean, you're not really getting any more freedom out of that. I don't even mean in the Richard Stallman hug a tree kind of way of freedom. You're still locking yourself into a vendor there. And if you just want to run Windows programs, go run Windows. You know, Linux is not at its best at that point. Mac OS is not at its best at that point. It's just crappy ports of Windows software. So that being said, Transgaming has a piece of software called Swiss Shader, which is like geek porn. It's like, it's not actually porn, don't get nervous, but it takes, and this is what I was going to say too, it takes a Direct3D program and it emulates the Direct3D API in software, and they do it really fast, so you can have something that looks mostly like a DirectX 9 game without using any hardware. It's incredible they can make this happen at all. It's very impressive technology. So I don't want to diss on them. I do really think that Transgaming is some of the smartest people out there, and Codeweavers is some of the smartest people out there. They're the other Wine people, and I just don't know that. I think I used to think maybe it's a good stopgap measure, but I'm starting to believe that that's not even a good idea anymore. So there comes a point where you have to say, I don't need to play that game that badly. There's lots of other games out there that are, and I'm not even talking like, oh, I can play Tetris instead of Quake 4, you know, it's like, there's lots of games of every caliber on Linux without having to run the Windows version of it, and I just think that there comes a point where you're kind of becoming the slave to a master that you just don't need to be the slave of. It's not a good idea. I don't know. So, I don't know. Any other questions? Yes?
You had talked a little bit about tools and Valgrind and SDL.
Yes.
What's something else that you can't live without? You as a developer of...
Well, everyone has their favorite text editor, right? I don't know.
What is yours?
There is no right.
Don't think curiosity.
Well, what do you think it is? I don't know. What kind of person do I
don't say nano. Don't say VI.
It's not. Well, I'll tell you. And you know what? Honest to God, I'll tell you the entire truth of the VI and the Emacs thing. It's not that one is better than the other. It's what you started with. The editor I use is called FTE. I don't know what that stands for. Nobody's developing it. It hasn't been updated in years. But it has the same key bindings as edit.com from DOS. And you use what you start with. And the reason that VI is not normal for human beings, and neither is Emacs, but when you get used to hitting Control X, A, something or other, you know, once you get used to that, you can pry that out of my cold, dead hands, whatever it is. And I think that's true for whatever text editor you use. It's just whatever you started with, whatever you get comfortable with, it would be like cutting off your arm to have to change text editors, because that's where you spend all your working hours as a programmer. And every now and then I have to go into Visual Studio to, like, tweak something, and it's like, it's like being, like, functionally retarded. It's not cool. But the Visual Studio people, they love it, man. It's fast, fast. You know, for them, but not for me. Which brings up an interesting point. When I was at Google, I noticed that everyone has those really big 23-inch displays from Dell that you can turn 90 degrees. And I noticed that the Windows developers tended to keep them horizontal, and the Unix people tended to make them vertical, because the Unix people like their 80-character limit. Visual Studio people, man, they'll do like 500 characters on the line. They don't care. So the further that thing will stretch across, the happier they are. So it's all what you grew up with, is what I'm saying. And so I think the editor thing is funny and a little bit stupid. So I think everyone feels that way, and no one had the guts to say it before me, so here I am to pass on the truth from the mountaintop to you guys. So I don't know.
FTE. Okay, Valgrind.
Yes. There's something that, I'm not sure I'm really married to this yet, but there's something called UndoDB. Has anyone heard of this? It's a reversible debugger. It's an extension to GNU's debugger, to GDB, which I like VI for some people. I speak it like it's English. But basically, they run your program, and you hit a breakpoint, and you can step backwards instead of only stepping forward. So the usual development cycle is when you're tracking down the bug, you try to stop as close to that bug as possible and then step forward to it very slowly and see what's going on. The problem is sometimes you don't know what's going on, so it would be really nice if you could have a time machine and go that direction, go back. It's that direction, I don't know. That way. what it'll do is it'll actually let you step back and it'll figure out... I think what it does is it just runs the x86 opcodes backwards. So if you just ran over an add instruction, it'll just subtract that much. Well, you're laughing, but, you know, when you don't know where the bug is and you need to step back, you know, 3 minutes and figure out, you can just keep going.
It's not the concept, it's the explanation. Absolutely. Absolutely right. Because a lot of times you don't know it's gone wrong until it's already wrong.
Exactly.
And then you don't know where it happened. So being able to step backwards through code is...
And you can set breakpoints. You can also, if you hit a seg fault, you can just step backwards from the seg fault and be like, okay, this pointer was now null. Why is it null? And go back up the program to find it's TiVo for debugging. The problem is it's commercial, and it's using GDB, but GDB has some mechanism where you can talk to remote programs, so you can like debug over a serial line, and they're using that interface not to violate the GPL, but to circumvent it and sell you a debugger for $400.
Nice.
But it's such a fantastic tool when it works that, you know, suddenly you find you have moral variability about things, much like Luke Skywalker kissing his sister. There's probably
other tools. Called UndoDB?
UndoDB, and it's a commercial piece of software. I think it's just undodb.com is where it is if you want it. You may only use it once, but if it saves you 20 hours of tracking down an obscure bug, it probably was worth your sanity. But it is closed source, and it's frustrating because it's using a piece of GPL stuff and kind of legally circumventing in a legal way, which nobody ever likes, but that's how they do it. I don't know. In terms of tools, I keep it very simple. And like, I have a Mac here, but mostly I use it because it's a collection of Xterms. You know, I'm not really into a lot of fancy stuff. I hate IDEs. Like, everyone's like, oh, Eclipse is great, or Anjuta, or whatever that's called, is great. I don't know if I'm old school or I'm just afraid of change, but I try to keep it very simple. The command line stuff has worked very well for me, and it's what I'm used to. I don't think that's a good way for new people to start, but if you can do it, I think it's great. I don't know. I'm trying to think what other tools I might use. I found Twitter's really good. I know it's not really a Linux thing, but I find
you're probably the only person currently in the upstate of South Carolina who's active on Twitter. I know nobody.
Seriously?
Else around here on Twitter. Nobody.
Interesting. Does anyone read Hacker News? It's the Y Combinator site? No? Okay. There's a guy named Paul Graham who does venture startup stuff. He gives you like a package of ramen noodles and says, good luck. You know, go make your startup company. But he runs an RSS feed and a little forum software for entrepreneur stuff and hacker stuff in the tinkerer term of hacking. And someone had asked the other day, you know, if there's anyone in Charlotte, North Carolina that's a hacker. And a few people did show up. So I think they're there. I'm from Charlotte. I was actually very surprised to find how far away this place was from where I was coming. Because when you hear Upper Carolina, I was like, well, they're in South Carolina. I said, Upper? So that's got to be right near the border where Charlotte is. Apparently, this actually refers to, like, mountains or something. I was wrong about that. But I think they're out there. Charlotte is notorious for being a banking town. There's a lot of programmers that are writing Java for Bank of America and Wachovia, which is, like, I think that's actually a ring of hell. I think that, like, they probably murdered someone in a past life, and now they write Java for Wachovia. But they are out there, and I think there are Linux people, and not just Linux users, but like those hardcore hackers. They're just, they don't write curse words on Twitter like I do, so I don't know. It's if you look, I was very surprised. I didn't know what to expect when I came here tonight. I was afraid it was going to be two dorks in a basement.
Hey, at least three people called you.
Not for nothing, but you know, I mean, when you say love, people do tend to think, you know, like, you never know what you're going to get. But there's a bunch of people here, and you all seem very decent and normal. I was concerned, and you know, I mean, I was surprised that South Carolina, which you don't really think of South Carolina as an entire state, as having a tech population. But you guys are all here, so I mean, imagine when
you're far from here, though.
Sure, but I mean, you think about these things like Raleigh, North Carolina, is really not what I would call. You know, you get up there and you hear that dueling banjos playing. It's like ding, 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 ding. But Red Hat's there, you know, and Research Triangle Park is there. What's that?
Only a person from Charlotte would say that about Raleigh.
I was going to say.
You do realize
I lived in Raleigh for many years. So,
you do realize that the movie that you made an allusion to was filmed in the upstate of South Carolina.
No kidding. I hope I locked my car door. But anyway, but you know, you go to Research Triangle Park and Epic Games is there, and you know, it's remarkable how these things work, because when people thought about video games, they used to think about Los Angeles, which is like the worst place on the planet. Having lived there, I am never going back.
Yeah.
But everything you've heard about is true, unfortunately. But that's where, like, Electronic Arts was there, and, like, big-name video game companies were there. But all you need is in software to set up a shop in Dallas. And now Dallas and Austin are big video game centers in Texas. And Epic is out in the middle of nowhere in Raleigh. I mean, I know there are places that are not the middle of nowhere in Raleigh, but they are in the middle of nowhere. And now suddenly people are going, oh, my gosh, I can't afford a house in Los Angeles, but I can get a really nice house in Raleigh. And one of the best game developers in the country is there now. And now suddenly a bunch of little game developers show up. And four or five have sprung up in the last few years. And it's only going to get bigger. And, you know, Research Triangle Park is brought in people and stuff like that. So I don't want anyone here to think that they're in a vast technical wasteland. Because it's not true. You'd be surprised who's around. You know?
We're just next to the wasteland.
Well, we're just here until the price of real estate goes up.
Yeah, it'll be a few years. Yeah, you want to get comfortable, but yeah. So I don't know if that. I like Twitter because you can say smart-ass things. That's like haiku. You know, you have to say it very succinctly because you only get 140 characters. But I don't know. In terms of tools, I think we're starting to find a phenomenon. I think this benefits Linux, that everything's moving to the web. And things that we never thought we would need, like Twitter, are showing up. And it's like, if this was 1992, and there was an internet, and you know, everyone was on it like they are now, everyone would be writing rich client-side applications for things, in the same way that everyone wrote an IRC client, yeah, and everyone wrote an FTP client, and everyone wrote blah blah blah. But now, and you can thank Hotmail for this before, when it was still cool, you know, we started to see things move to the web, and the real winner there was Linux and macOS and Amiga, whatever. But, and the real loser there was Microsoft, because now you don't need a Windows application to do whatever. And that's beneficial even if you're using just Windows, because you don't need to be on your desktop. You can be on Bob's desktop and just hit Hotmail or whatever. And that has helped a great deal in terms of tools that we're not so much interested in, you know, rich clients anymore. The only things that we haven't really found a good way to do, and I don't think we ever will, is source control.
I was just about to ask that.
I'm sort of in love with Mercurial right now, but I recognize that no mere mortal uses it. Subversion, I think, is pretty much what anyone needs until they're at the scale of, say, the Linux kernel, in which case they need Git. Mercurial's probably not even going to help them there. If anyone's still using CVS, please kill yourself. It's time. Move on. It's a dead program. You shouldn't be using it anymore. Convert to Subversion and find a new lease on life.
What do you think of Bazaar?
I haven't used Bazaar, but I recognize I saw that Launchpad.net, Ubuntu's thing, uses it. And I posted one of my open source projects that I work on. Tools. We'll get to that in a second. I feel like I'm about to pass out from talking too much. You guys probably all feel the same also, so I'll stop soon. But they use it, and I mentioned I have some piece of source code, and they're sucked into a Bazaar repository. And they just keep pulling from my public Subversion repository every time. And I thought that was cool, but I don't really know much about it other than that. So, Launchpad.net, their translation stuff is fantastic. You need to stop thinking like Americans. There are people that don't speak English, as I learned last week in Germany. everyone tells you that everyone in Germany speaks English as a second language. It's not true in Frankfurt. Don't go there if you don't speak German. But
You're far from home when you're on a plane, and there's multiple the announcements are in multiple languages, and none of them are English.
Uh-oh. This could be a problem. What would MacGyver do here?
It doesn't matter. I'm a plane you've heard of all anyway.
Yeah, that's true, too. But my point being that where Linux is going to take off is not America. I mean, it's going to eventually. I think that it's just a question of time before it hits critical mass. Even Bill Gates knows this. Back in 2004, someone asked him, he's like, 10 years from now, it's going to be Windows and Linux. One, I think he was wrong because he didn't count on Mac OS ceasing to suck. But also, I don't think he counted on Vista sucking as much as it did. Sorry, Bill. But the point being that, also, the clock is ticking, so, 6 years to go, we'll see if he's right. But it's not going to start in America. Because there's this big corporate culture. Where it's going to start is China. Where it's going to start is Russia, where they don't want to pay for the Windows license. And the hardware, a Windows license is not just like a month of their salary. It could be more than a year of their salary when they make $3 a month in comparison to America. Then again, when you look at the euro, we're going to be making $3 a month pretty soon, too. But I think that you're going to find out that when 6 million Chinese people a day start using Linux as their primary operating system, there's going to come a point where if you want to do business outside of America, you're going to need to have a Linux version. And I think that the problem with that is that nobody's thinking about localization right now at all. In terms of open source, you're lucky that there's probably someone, as Launchpad.net has taught me, because Mojo Setup now has 31 different languages after like 3 weeks of people contributing. There are languages I've never heard of that open source project is now translated into because of this. But if you want to have a successful product, whether it's open source or closed source or anything else, whether it's an embedded microwave device, whatever, that you're going to sell, it has to handle more than just English. It has to handle more than just ASCII. And this is something you can be thinking about now, games or otherwise. 9/10 of the development community in America is not thinking about this. And it's very, very important because it's going to be a very global economy, and Linux itself is going to not really take off in America until it takes off elsewhere. So keep that in mind, as one laptop per child is going to show us. When you start to have to think about things like, how does my program handle this when suddenly the text goes that way instead of this way in Arabic? In terms of tools, I found Launchpad was good for that. In terms of a web thing, is that I can barely speak English, So I mean, when you have to, even if you just want what the industry refers to as the FIGS languages, French, Italian, German, and Spanish, I'm already 4 languages down there. I need help on that. So, keeping in mind these things right from the start, not hard-coding things where you assume a character is one byte, and not hard-coding things where you assume that A through Z is the only thing in the alphabet, will do you a lot of good in the next 10 years. Start now. Yes?
Do
along with the concept of the language, how does the language impact your code itself?
The natural language or the programming language?
The natural language in terms of open source code. I mean, we write our code typically with an English flavor in the code.
Oh, you mean like in terms of comments and stuff? You're lucky there. English is kind of the lingua franca. I don't know if that's actually a term I just
lingua
used.
Lingua franca.
Did I make that up?
International business language.
Score. It's kind of it's the Rosetta Stone. Whatever. English is what people write programs in for the most part. In fact, it's even strange to go to, say, a Japanese company and see comments that aren't in English. Sometimes very broken English, but English nonetheless. Well, I don't want to go there, but I mean, partially that's the fact that the C language itself, the syntax, doesn't allow for extended characters. And I mean, when you're talking about UTF-8, it's just a string of bytes after the comment. They could do it, but the fact that you can only pretty much use English characters in your function names and variable names and stuff like that helps a lot. It's gotten to the point where you may not need to speak English to get along in the world, but you really do need to speak it to get along in programming circles for the most part. And you see this even on mailing lists for development and stuff, that you know, if all your primary developers for something important, like, say, the X server, only speak English, the cost of doing business with them is you have to speak English, too. Now, if the X server was developed in China entirely, then I'd be learning Chinese right now.
Goodbye.
Well, I'm probably too old, but
I believe we have several people in this room learning Mandarin right now.
No kidding. Yes?
When you were 40, a few games, have you been, like, oh my goodness, why is this program programmed in COBOL or whatever?
Hey, watch it.
The pretty much universal language is C and C++, almost entirely C++. A couple years ago, you'd find some C stuff, and a couple years before that, you would find little snippets of inline assembly language wedged into the C code, but for the most part, almost everyone is using C++ now. So I haven't seen a lot of things where it's like, why would you write in that language? But I have seen a lot of code where it's like, why would you write that at all? What is wrong with you? There's so many bad practices that you know are bad practices when you write it, but I think a lot of people... game development is not unique in this, but game development is really bad in that people go into crunch time, which is to say they work 18-hour days, sleep under their desk, get up again, and start working again. And crunch time is something that's good for the soul every now and then for maybe a week. And then you take a week off, you hang out with your family, you go to the beach, whatever you want to do. But in the game development industry, sometimes crunch time goes for a year or so. And these people don't come back to work after these jobs because it's kind of like, you know, post-traumatic stress syndrome. You know, it's just like there comes a point where people burn out. But somewhere between when they burn out and where the crunch time started, they start not caring so much about code quality.
You mean you might find say that the game has to do something to every single object that may met some condition or whatever. There might be like a for loop that says that, you know.
Yes.
And that just goes through each individual number in the array of objects when they could have just do a for each.
I could tell you things that would just embarrass you. There is no such thing as good video game code, generally speaking. There are very few exceptions to this rule, but I think the most instructive thing, and I've said this before, I think, but there's a game called Descent 1, which they gave the source code out to because they decided they weren't ever going to make any more money off of this, and there's a README file in the source code because they did an interview with the original developers to ask them questions about it. And one of the first questions in there is, well, can you tell us a piece of this program that you're really proud of that people should look at as an example of good code? No. No, nothing in the entire program. No, nothing. And then they started talking about, like, they had anecdotes about, like, oh, you wrote that when you hadn't slept in 4 days and stuff like that. And, you know, code quality, you'd be surprised that writing good code is sometimes a matter of taking care of yourself as a physical being and an emotional being. And when you aren't doing that, code quality goes down the toilet. You know, it's like, people do things that are mistakes, like you said with the for loop, when a good iterator like for each would be much better, or trying to separate out just what they need to do instead of just kind of brute forcing through it. A lot of things is just like, this had to work for a demo that we were going to show at this trade show 3 years ago, and this code never got rewritten because we're on to the next thing. And I can't tell you the number of times I've heard that specific story, but I don't think that's reflective of open source, because the beautiful thing about free software is that you don't get to have an ego. Everyone's going to see your code, and if it's really bad, people do talk about you behind your back.
Or to your face.
Or sometimes to your face, depending on where you go. But and, you know, bad code doesn't stand either. Jokes about people making fun of you aside, bad code gets rewritten. And whether it gets rewritten by the original person or someone else coming in going, that just offends my techie soul, I need to go fix that, it gets fixed. But in closed source stuff, where it's a couple of guys that are getting paid to do this, don't really care about beyond their paycheck, code quality goes through the toilet, and Windows. I mean, seriously. Yes, actually, seriously, Windows to a degree. And I think there are people on any project, including Windows, that are passionate about it. Like, you can read Raymond Chen's blog, and it's fascinating reading. But there are always going to be, as projects scale, as you have more people working on it, bad decisions get made. Instead of doing what you see a lot in open source, where they go, this didn't work out as well as we want, rip the entire thing out and put something new in there, better system, they start building on the bad thing instead.
Oh, so that's why there are so many lines of code in Windows.
Well, yes, but also, more importantly, you start to see that there's different versions, like every program ships with a different version of the C runtime, and there's what they call DLL hell on Windows and stuff like that. Where it's not just that there are bad decisions, but there's bad decisions that are version specific. This thing has to work with Internet Explorer 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and each of them have new and interesting bugs, you know, for example. And they do, and Mozilla does too, to be fair, but you can fix those things. Whereas you're going to have to support Internet Explorer forever. Whereas Ubuntu can be like, you know, man, just run apt-get and just upgrade Mozilla, and then the bug is gone, you know? So that's a fundamental problem with closed-source stuff. Not just in terms of the code you write, but the code you have to support. But yeah, it's just some awful, awful code in every video game you'll ever see. The best of them is probably John Carmack, because he recognizes when his code's bad and he finds a good excuse for why it should be that way. tons and tons of really, like, the first thing they'll tell you in computer science is don't use global variables, they're bad, which isn't always true, but everything in the Quake source code's a global variable, you know. It's just, but, you know, it's he's much more interested in something that runs quickly, is easy to understand later, even if it isn't quote-unquote good practices. And there's a famous piece of code in Quake 3, which you can see because it's GPL software now, where they calculate a square root with this really magical number, and it's like they're doing like a bitwise operation on it, and it works. It gives you the right value for the square root, but nobody knows how it works. It's just one of those things you just shouldn't poke too much.
Someone chased him down, I think.
No one's ever figured out who it came from originally. They thought it was Michael Abrash, but it's not.
Well, but then they went even further and found someone else that did actually figure out that on a 32-bit processor, Intel processor, that they just put a bunch of numbers together and the square root turned out to be the best with this. With this algorithm.
Anyway, if you can look it up, you could actually just go to Google and punch in like Quake 3 square root, and there's people have blogged about it. It's like a 3-line function. But people have, like, it's like an archaeological dig trying to figure out what on earth happened there and why mathematically this works.
The same thing with, like, E and sign and all that stuff.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I mean, people,
but
I mean,
it's not common.
Well, no, what are you going to say about it?
It's a game code.
Well, I mean, you see comments sometimes, but the comment would be like, this is where the magic happens. I do not know what else to tell you about that. Yeah, but I mean, code quality is bad in the game industry, generally speaking. So, yes?
What's your favorite Linux?
Ubuntu. I love it. I grew up and I kind of like my Linux distribution to punish me a little bit. Like, it keeps you honest. You start with Slacker out of necessity, but I guess, you know, if you grow up in an abusive relationship, you always seek them out. So I moved on to Gentoo from there.
Yes!
And, you know, it got to the point, the reason I moved from Slackware to Gentoo is that I like the idea that you had to compile everything in my sick, warped mind, but it got to the point where I just didn't feel like spending time tracking down dependencies and finding the right magic for the configure script and stuff. So Gentoo basically was Slackware with that crap automated. And then then I grew up, and I was like, I just need something that installs things without bothering me. And Ubuntu is really, I think in terms of a user-friendly thing, it's like I said, the thing I like about the Mac is that sooner or later I can just have a whole pile of Xterms opened and, you know, running text editors in them and stuff. So I don't really need all those cool things like, you know, iTunes and stuff like that.
Or having your computer on your desk in your desktop.
That's right. VMware is another good tool, by the way, speaking of which. But Ubuntu, mostly, for the most part. I just think it stays out of my way, and I used to hate that, but now I love it, and I think that probably makes me...
Old.
I think old is the word I'm looking for. But, I don't know. I think we have a problem. There's too many Linux distributions. I don't think there should be just one, because I think the competition benefits everyone. But there's too damn many of them now, and I think it's at the point where it's actually slowing everyone down. So, I don't know. Yes?
Is the death of PC gaming greatly exaggerated? I know even Carmack said he was considering moving more towards consoles because of piracy.
Here's how it works. There's a 5-year console cycle. You ready for this? And you can see this if you look at the PlayStation 1, PlayStation 2, PlayStation 3. And it goes like this. This is where you introduce the PlayStation or Xbox or Wii or whatever like that. This is when everyone's writing games for it that are awesome, and this is where they predict the PC will die, and this is where everyone starts writing PC games again because the hardware is 5 years ahead of the console you're writing for. Happens every time. And they always threaten to do this, but I'm willing to call their bluff. I think that the other thing that's really important is this. You and me, and you and you and you, and everyone else can't compete on a console. Because even if you're willing to pay the $10,000 for a Wii development unit, could you imagine paying $10,000 for a computer to write a game? That's just ridiculous. But that's like, I mean, I think the Wii's the cheap one. Like, you go to the PlayStation 3 and the Xbox 360, you might pay $30,000 for a single development box for the thing. And each developer needs one. Like, each individual developer. I don't mean like a game company. So, like, it's ridiculous, but... Even if you had that money, they won't sell it to you. In fact, if you want to get into the WiiWare program, Nintendo will sell it to individuals now, but not if you only have a residential address. You need to have an office space or they won't sell it to you. I know, it's ridiculous. I don't even get me into it. But the point being, you can't compete on that. But even if you could write to the console, you can't compete with Madden 2009 because EA is going to make a game that's awesome because they can spend $60 million on it. And since it's Madden, they're going to recoup that money. It's worth noting that Madden 2009 will not be shipping for the PC. This is the first time in like 12 years they're not doing a PC version of it.
I've been waiting for the PC version of the NCAA football. And it's been forever. It was just a slight tweak to Madden, but they only offered the PC version once and never again.
Here's the good news. Let them go to the consoles. Goodbye, goodbye. Now the guy that's sitting in his garage that has a PC and a friend who's an artist can make competitive games for the PC where they can't now.
Passport.
What's that?
Game on Hydra. We call it Passport.
What is it?
It's like a puzzle game. It's just a 2D scroller. Some guy in Germany wrote it in his garage.
Yeah. Well, and I think if you look back in history, all the big games now all started out as a guy in their garage. Yeah. And the classic example is John Carmack, who is now doing things like Rage and Quake 4 and stuff, and Doom 3 and stuff like that. But he started out with him and John Romero and Jay Wilbur sitting around a table that, you know, they quit their jobs and just, you know, did their thing. So.
Yeah, when they go to... When the big game companies go to writing games only for the consoles, they're opening up a whole segment of the market.
Exactly.
For people that are refusing to buy the consoles. They're abandoning that market segment, and like you say, other people will step in to say, okay, we'll write games for the PC market.
This is what I said. Markets never go away. Vacuums get filled. And the thing is, people aren't going to stop playing games on their computers. And what you will find is that a lot of people will say they're not gamers. It's not true. They all play Puzzle Quest. They all play Bejeweled. They just don't think of it as gaming. Because gaming, when people think about it, they think about the Xbox, or they think about the hardcore jackasses playing Halo or whatnot like that. But everyone is a gamer that plays a computer game. It might just be Minesweeper and Solitaire, but everyone is a gamer. And they're still going to buy games for the PC. Now that's a vacuum that can be filled by you and me and people that don't have $40 million to make the super awesome game. Because the secret was, the games were never awesome because they looked good. They're expensive because they look good. But Pac-Man was awesome, and it looked like shit. So, excuse my language. So I don't know if it's true that they're going to go... The PC gaming is dying in the sense that the console gamers are going to stop making PC games. I think Valve is going to keep making Half-Life and Steam because that's a huge market for them. Because they were smart enough to recognize that digital distribution was going to be important long before the Wii Virtual Console or Xbox Live Arcade. Valve figured that out. They're not going to go away. But even if they do, if everyone flips the PC, the burden goes to the console, it opens up a market for people who can't afford to compete on the consoles, and that market will still be filled. And by the way, those independent developers, they seem to like Linux a lot. For the same reason that Dave Taylor, who was an independent developer, said that Linux gave him a Woody. I can't help but notice that the people that are willing to do this without a budget and eat ramen noodles and pray for the best with their silly little game, they tend to be technically inclined. They tend to be concerned about code quality. They tend to, care about different platforms because they're using these platforms themselves. And, I don't know if PC gaming is dying, but if it is in the way that people mean it when they say that, it's a massive win for you as a consumer, for you as a Linux user. I hope it happens. I've been hoping it happens for years. It might put me out of business, but that's okay. I'll go write Java for Wachovia or something. I won't start. So, any other questions? I feel like I'm taking all of your time tonight. You can go, catch Lost or something on reruns or something. I don't know. But any questions? Anything? All right, I guess I'm done. Thank you for playing the plan.
Thank you for listening to Massive Public Radio. HCR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.